Hello and welcome to a brand new season of WGTC Radio, the official podcast of entertainment website We Got This Covered. I am Jonathan Lack.
And I'm Sean Chapman.
And as always, we are here to talk about stuff.
Yes.
In this case, Sean, this is the start of our third year of WGTC Radio.
Oh, God.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Episode 75.
Although we only really did like one full year, right?
Yeah. Well, year one, we did 26 episodes. Year two, we did 49.
Okay.
And this is what's... I have some stats from season two of WGTC Radio I want to share with the listeners because I think they're kind of funny.
Sure.
We had some gaps in 2013 where we just got busy and weren't able to record episodes. Somehow, we still knocked out 49 episodes last year.
Yeah, that doesn't... In my head, that math shouldn't work. That
no, shouldn't, it shouldn't.
With how many I know we missed.
We only had two in December, for instance.
Huh.
But I know we also had weeks where we did like three in 1 week.
Yeah.
Because this was a crazy year in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And season two, total podcasting time. If you add up every episode we recorded, it's 108 hours, 5 minutes and 49 seconds, which equates to 4.5 days.
God.
Straight podcasting.
God. God, Jesus.
So if you want to listen to the complete second season of WGTC Radio, you have a lot of listening to do.
I spent 4.5 days worth of total time last year talking to you. Good God. Oh, shit.
Wow.
What am I doing with my life?
Am I supposed to be insulted by that?
Take it as you wish.
Okay. All right. Sean, today for season three premiere, we're going to go back and look at 2013. Talk about that year in review. If you've heard our previous year in review episodes, we'll just talk about movies, our favorite games. My top 10 favorite movies of the year, that's out online. That came out mid-December, so you can go read that. There's also an extra Next Best 20 article, so top 30 overall. But Sean, the kids don't know your top 10 games.
Yeah.
They don't know my top 10 games.
Yeah.
And we haven't talked about TV other than Doctor Who all year.
Yeah.
So I've got some of that to talk
about. Oh, okay.
All right.
Yeah.
So... that's what this episode is. Sean, how was 2013 for you? What kind of year was it?
I thought it was pretty good, like especially, you know, looking at it in context of video games, which is how I do most of my life. I just look at it in context of what video games I played. It's a pretty good fucking year. Like a lot of really interesting, really fantastic games came out, and then other than that, I didn't watch a lot of movies, so like that's not, you know.
Yeah.
Although the movies that I did watch were all pretty good, like Thor 2, that was a good fucking movie. Hobbit. That was a good movie.
All right, yeah, no, I like 2013, you know,
The shitty, like, number for a year, I'll say. I've never been a fan of 13 itself, but,
no.
Like, 2013, we're in the teens, it's just a bad spot, you know?
It is.
I don't like it.
I think when we get into the 2020s, so it's gonna be better.
Yeah, that's a lot better, but, yeah like, 2014, like, God, once you get to 2017, like, that's just... gross.
I know. It doesn't... I feel like we're in a state where I just don't want to say numbers of years for a while now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well. But yes, so 2013 for me, good year overall. Some rough stuff in my personal life, I guess, but overall, 2013, you know, like being sick for the entire month of December, that kind of sucked. But no, overall, for media, this is a landmark year because I think this was one of the all-time great modern movie years, as we're going to talk about. This was one of the all-time great video game years, and a very significant year for gaming.
Yeah, I mean, fuck, the fucking PS4 and Xbox One came out this year.
Yeah, and I think also the indie game explosion continued in really interesting ways. I think for television, there was more good TV than ever before out there. And that doesn't mean, like, the all-time greatest TV show aired this year, necessarily. But, man, there was so much. I wish I could have covered more of it. I kind of prioritized movies and gaming this year. Still have some TV shows to talk about. But yeah, this was a great, great year just for media. If you were interested in movies, you know, gaming. I don't know about music or books. I don't read modern books or listen to modern music, really.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, who reads modern books? It's just...
yeah, that does seem like a thing where no one talks about that. That's just not a thing. Like, occasionally...
it's like, other than, like, whatever recent young adult novel got made into the, like, best-selling movie of the year. Like, whatever.
Yeah. A lot of people discovered 50 Shades of Grey this year, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I had to explain to... my mom recently asked me, should I read 50 Shades of Grey?
And what did you say?
I had to explain to her what it was, and then she didn't want to read it, but I was very tempted
to,
like...
but she secretly actually wanted to read
it. I was very tempted...
she's probably reading it right now.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I was very tempted to just give her a copy because it would be funny.
Yeah.
But yes.
But, yeah.
Yes. So, That's how it works.
Yeah, 2013, pretty good year, you know. Luigi did a pretty good job, I thought. It was his year, I guess. I
mean, and now we never get to talk...
That's what Nintendo said, it was the year of Luigi.
Right, and now
I guess they just get to decide that shit, whose year it is.
And now we don't get to talk about Luigi anymore. He had his year, he's gone.
Except for, I mean... Did that Dr. Luigi game come out yet, or is that still coming?
That's still coming.
Okay, so I guess the year of Luigi's not fucking done.
I think
Nintendo works on their own goddamn calendar.
They do. It's, you know, it's like the Mayan calendar or something. Yeah. It's their own thing. No, I think we need the year of Waluigi. I think that's what we've been waiting for.
I mean, I think you need to... We haven't actually technically had a year of fucking Mario yet, so it seems like you have to work your way down the ladder before you get to Waluigi. I don't even know. Where the fuck did Waluigi even come from?
Mario Tennis.
Okay, it's Mario Tennis. Yeah. It's just... I knew it was from some area in the Mario spinoff games where they're like... We have Wario, and people like Wario, and we have Luigi, and nobody really gives a shit about Luigi. So let's, like, make the evil spinoff of Luigi for our fucking tennis game, and then put him in, like, Mario Party and golf and shit.
I was introduced to him through Mario Party, but I guess he was from Mario Tennis for the Nintendo 64.
Yeah, because I definitely saw him in Mario Party first.
I forget which one he came out. I think it was Mario Party 3, because I think it was on the N64. All right. Well, anyway,
Waluigi.
2014 year of Waluigi. Congratulations, you earned it, kid.
Yeah. Hopefully, they'll put you in like the new Smash Bros.
I don't think Waluigi has even been in a game since Mario Kart Wii.
Probably not. I don't. Yeah. Yeah. I don't. I'm not into the whole Mario thing anymore.
Yeah. Who knows? Anyway,
they should just like make the next big Mario game just a Waluigi game. Just retire Mario entirely.
Yeah. All right, Sean.
New Waluigi brothers.
You want to get down to business here?
No, but sure. Let's do it.
Okay. Well, what do you want to talk about instead?
Waluigi some more. I'm fascinated by Waluigi, honestly. He's such a bizarre character to me, but...
He is.
But I don't know, like... I don't know how far we can really take this, so...
Okay. Alright.
Let's just do a fucking... Let's do what we're good at. Let's just, like, talk about lists. So.
Okay. Sean, let's talk about some movies to get things started.
Okay.
I have an actual, you know, top 10. I watch movies, but I want to start this with you. What movies did you watch this year that you liked?
I already said them. I saw Thor 2. I saw The Hobbit 2. Both of those really good.
Okay. Anything else you liked?
I saw Gravity. Gravity was pretty good.
Okay.
But I didn't like Sandra Bullock that much in it.
You're like the only person, but go ahead.
Hey, I'm the only person right about Gravity then.
Okay.
The only remarkable thing about that movie was the special effects.
That's so
I'm actually
cool.
Trying to remember what... Was there, I don't even know if I saw any other movie in the theater this year. I'm trying to fucking...
You saw Iron Man 3.
Iron Man 3, yeah, that was that.
You saw Man of Steel. You didn't like it.
That's right. Man of Steel came out this year. I'm trying to, like, it's... Because I'm so precise on, like, when video games have come out. And as soon as I see a movie, I forget when I saw that movie. So Man of Steel could have come out 5 years ago for all I fucking know. Yeah, Man of Steel, that was the worst movie I saw this year.
Okay.
So that.
You did not see a lot of movies this year,
yeah,
then.
No. I don't go see movies in the theater that often.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, you want me to talk about some movies?
Sure.
All right.
Did any of the movies I see are on your list? I don't know. Have I
just
seen
Gravity, okay. I think. I don't know. I don't think you've seen a single other movie on my list.
Yep, nope.
Okay. Some of these you literally couldn't have seen yet.
Yeah.
So, yeah, unfair in some ways. But yes. All right. I had a top 30 this year. Numbers 11 through 30 were not ranked. They were alphabetized. I'm not going to go through all those. I will go with one honorable mention, which if I had ranked this list all the way out to 30, would have been 11.
Okay.
Because this was the one that was hard to leave off. And I should say, this was a different year for me because there were so many good movies. And so many of them just kind of snuck up on me, especially in the last couple weeks in the year when I was kind of playing catch-up. Normally, my sort of ethos when I make my movie top 10 list, and I've been doing this for a long fucking time now, so I've kind of gotten it down to a method, is that I treat it like as my favorite, you know, not empirical best. This year, I kind of had to go with an empirical best approach overall because it was such a tough year. And there were so many movies I really loved, like... I could not love Thor 2 more if I tried, but I probably shouldn't put that on my top 10.
You really should have. But.
It's in my top 30, absolutely, but I wouldn't have known how to rank that against...
Does any of these other movies have a moment as great as Thor walking into that apartment and hanging up his hammer on a coat hook? Does any of these movies even approach the level of greatness as that moment on screen?
Level of greatness, yes, but maybe not level of sheer happiness in my heart.
Yeah, so Thor 2 is the actual number one movie of the year, I think, is what I'm hearing.
Thor 2 is great, but no, I really did kind of go with... Definitely, they play to my preferences and my personal tastes and all that, because when I say empirical best, that's only within my own, you know, scope of opinion, obviously. Yeah,
so it's not empirical at all.
Okay, yeah. But anyway, that was more of kind of the approach I wound up taking, because it was the easiest way to try to make this fucking monster of a list work and narrow it down. But I really did feel like with the top 10, this is the best top 10 list I've ever had. These 10 movies, I feel like you could make an argument, all of them being masterworks, landmark works in their given genre or field. And that's really special to me, because I've had, in years past, I always feel like I can have a couple of those, maybe the top 3, top 4, top 5. Mm-hmm. But then definitely on the down ballot, the 7s, 8s, 9s, and 10s, they're not weaker movies. They're movies I love really intensely. But, you know, I've had movies, usually I have like a blockbuster spot on my list.
Yeah.
And last year that was Skyfall for me, because that was my favorite. I'm a big James Bond fan. Totally earned it, I felt, but you know, Skyfall is not a masterpiece, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Where I really feel like
it's no Thor 2.
No, it's no Thor 2. Thor 2 is the Skyfall of superhero movies. As Skyfall is to James Bond, Thor 2 is to Thor.
Maybe. I don't know. I would need to process that statement a little more to really comment on it.
All right. No, but yes, so with that in mind, a movie that really, really meant a lot to me that I wound up putting at, like I said, what would have been number 11 was this film by Richard Curtis called About Time, British film. Came out in England maybe over the summer, came out here in November, had very little press or promotion, was in and out of theaters really quick. Really great movie. You know, if you know Richard Curtis, you'd like Richard Curtis, Sean, because he created Blackadder.
Okay, yeah, that's a good fucking show.
Yeah, and since then he's known for writing romantic comedies, not in the like shitty what other kind of movies Sandra Bullock does, romantic comedies.
Yeah.
But, you know, like Love Actually is he's famous for, I think that's probably his most famous modern movie, Four Weddings and a Funeral, that kind of stuff. I'm not all that familiar with his film work. He wrote the Vincent and the Doctor episode of Doctor Who.
That's good, yeah.
So that's who Richard Curtis is. This is his last movie as a director, he says. He says he's going to retire from directing after this. About Time is about, basically it's this family. The main character in the movie is played by Domhnall Gleeson. The father is played by Bill Nighy, and all the men in this family basically have the ability to travel through time. But the movie is not, you know, time travel sci-fi oriented in that way. It's just kind of a plot device. It's something they can do.
So it's like Doctor Who.
Yeah, and I think some people have, for some reason, tried to tear this movie apart for its time travel logic. That's so not what this movie is about. It's hilarious to me.
Yeah.
And they set some very basic rules, and they completely follow them, but that's not the point. It's basically the point of the movie is how this young man, as he grows up through life, kind of uses time travel to make his life better. Some ways he realizes he doesn't need it. Some ways, you know, it is necessary for him. He has this relationship with this woman played by Rachel McAdams, who is radiant and awesome in this movie. And honestly, the first hour of About Time is just wonderful because it is good romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. And by that I just mean it's so pleasant and charming and funny because you have two people who have really good chemistry, who are funny together because they actually enjoy each other's company. And I feel like people need to look at what Richard Curtis does here when they make quote-unquote romantic comedies, because most romantic comedies are two people who should be in love, like, sniping at each other.
Yeah.
I don't know why that's funny. That's just kind of sad when you kind of think about it. Like, oh man, this is a really bad relationship when you think about it. That's not happy. They are going to get divorced. They're like, you know, all their earnings are going to get split. It's going to be horrible.
Yeah, in 5 years, this is going to be an episode of Law & Order where the wife killed the guy.
Yeah, exactly. That's most romantic comedies. So, you know, About Time is just a really well-executed family story, romantic comedy story, really good. I think in its last half hour, it goes for something even deeper with the relationship between the father and son. And, you know, I've mentioned this before on the podcast, much of 2013 for me was dealing with the death of my own father from last year. And About Time was a movie I should not have seen in public. Because there is a moment at the end of About Time, basically where the father and son are dealing with mortality, and there's this one scene, it's where they kind of, this is what to me the time travel is in the movie for. And the way this scene plays out, oh my god, I have like teared up in a theater. This was embarrassing what this movie fucking did to me. And I remember getting out of the theater and being just like, laughing at how well I had been manipulated by this movie. But manipulated in a good way, because, you know, we talk about movie manipulation as bad. Movie manipulation can absolutely be good if it's done well.
Yeah.
And this is good movie manipulation. It is just great emotional stuff. I think it's beautifully acted by everyone, Bill Nighy especially. I think it's a great, fantastic movie. It's not, you know, if I'm looking at this in an absolute critical sense, no, it is not as good as the next 10. That's why it didn't make out in my top 10 list. Absolutely number 11 for me. Really love this movie. A lot of people, I think, dismissed it for really weird reasons to me. Or there's that typical thing of, I think critics and the public can kind of have trouble with actual genuine raw emotions when they're out there and just put on the table. And I think there's that line where, is it saccharine or is it genuine?
Mm-hmm.
I think this movie is very genuine. And I think you can mix those two up. But this movie is very genuine to me. So that was my number 11. But let me move faster through these next 10. Number 10 on the actual top 10 list is Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street, which is hard to describe in a short amount of time. So I guess I'll just say that nobody makes a Martin Scorsese movie like Martin Scorsese,
yes,
even at the age of 72.
Hmm.
I cannot believe that a 72-year-old man made The Wolf of Wall Street, because this has the energy, this has the inventiveness, this has the just the depth and just piercing raw anger of something you would expect of a, like, 30-year-old filmmaker, of someone trying to prove themselves. And I feel like Martin Scorsese has done that through his whole career, because he's never had laurels to rest upon, really. He's never been celebrated by the Academy Awards. He's always been kind of on the fringes of things.
Mm-hmm.
And his movies become classics, not in the moment, but maybe years later. And, you know, The Wolf of Wall Street is just him at his absolute best. And there was another movie this year called American Hustle that a lot of people are overpraising wildly. It's a fun movie, it's good, it's well acted, but it's, you know, completely surface level, and it's a Martin Scorsese homage. And The Wolf of Wall Street is the real thing. And when you, I saw those movies in the same week, and boy, when you hold them up next to each other, the real thing is so obvious. And Leonardo DiCaprio is just at his, this is probably his best performance. He's fantastic in this movie. If you know the plot, it's, he plays Jordan Belfort, a Wall Street tycoon. He kind of comes from middle class, goes to Wall Street, starts committing crimes, and becomes
as you do when you're in Wall Street. Yeah.
Yes, and
just
the movie
rite of passage.
And boy, this movie earns its R rating. It is absolutely wild.
Yeah.
There's a scene where Leonardo DiCaprio has a hot candle stuck up his ass. You know, things happen in this movie.
Well, yeah, like I want to see this movie. I haven't gotten around to it yet, but that was like one of the things I heard about, was like from people who'd seen the movie that like taken like maybe their grandfather
yep.
with them is like. Then they're describing some of the things that happen in the movie. It's like, oh,
yeah,
that's a movie you want to be careful who you go with.
Absolutely.
It might be very uncomfortable.
Wolf of Wall Street is an absolute, just bacchanal,
yeah,
raging.
It's one of those kinds of movies.
And it has to be, because it's, honestly, if you've seen Goodfellas, this is Goodfellas for the year 2013, where, you know, Goodfellas was analyzing sort of the intoxicating essence of the gangster lifestyle and how it intoxicates Henry Hill and how it ultimately brings him down. And really, it's just the way it ultimately realizes, you know, takes this character apart to be an absolute putz.
Yeah.
And it's really funny while it does it, but it's also very sharp in how it analyzes that lifestyle, specifically in an American context. Wolf of Wall Street does the same thing, but with our modern criminals who are, you know, the people who destroyed our economic system and caused damage for millions and millions of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So this movie, you know, there's been a lot of controversy over, you know, oh, is this movie moral or not? That doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
It is in the sense that it absolutely illustrates why this lifestyle exists, why it's intoxicating for this man, Jordan Belfort, why this system perpetuates, and it does it in this American context, and it leaves you to make your own conclusions. And if you're a sane individual, you will be disgusted by this even as you understand why this lifestyle exists. And that's the brilliance of Martin Scorsese's filmmaking technique. And it's something no one else does as well as him. This is the master at work, and it's great. All 3 hours of it. I could have watched more. You know, the original cut was 4 hours long. They had to whittle it down. Martin Scorsese has never released a director's cut. I would be really interested to see what this movie was in its longer form. Not that it feels incomplete at all. It's great.
It is always fascinating when you hear those stories of, like, directors who are like, yeah, the original cut of this movie was 8 hours. It's like, what?
Yeah.
How, like, where is all the, like, I would just be, it would be so fascinating to, like, just see all the cut footage and what the fuck that thing originally could have been, like, what monster they originally made.
But I think at 3 hours it's perfect, and man, they, and it just, it lets certain scenes breathe. There is this basically silent comedy set piece in the middle of the movie that lasts a good 20 minutes, and it is fantastic. It's like a mini movie within the movie itself, and it is great. All right, number 9, darker film. This is called The Act of Killing, Joshua Oppenheimer's documentary, which came out this summer. It focuses on the 1965-66 Indonesian anti-communist purgings, where over 500,000 people were murdered for suspicion of being communist. And you, if you know anything about the 60s, communist didn't really mean communist.
Yeah.
It meant something else. Basically, what Oppenheimer has done in The Act of Killing is he went to Indonesia initially to study the victims, but he wound up having access to the killers, who are today held up as heroes by the fascist regime government. and he interviews these people. He gets really, and they are completely honest. They have no shame. And so the movie is basically this study of, well, what is evil and how does it perpetuate when there's absolutely no check for it, when it's even celebrated? And it goes even further than that, because what Oppenheimer does is he gives the killers the chance to recreate their memories of the killings as film set pieces. They get studios, they get cameras, and they recreate it through the various genres, gangster movies, spy movies, musicals even, Bollywood kind of stuff, the genres that they themselves admit to have been inspired by when they did these killings. It's very hard to describe this movie and what it does, but it's fascinating, and it's one of the best documentaries ever made. It's absolutely a landmark. I think I said when I wrote about this in my top 10, few filmmakers have ever looked evil in the eye this intensely and unflinchingly, but moreover still, I've never seen a movie that analyzes sort of these ideas of evil and people who have committed acts of evil and makes that eye reflexive. And that's the real gift of the act of killing, is how these killers, through documentary form, through cinematic form, are changed and forced to look at themselves. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating study of the banality of evil theory, lots of different ways to approach it. This movie is at number 9, and I knew this had to be on my top 10, didn't quite know where to place it, because it's a very hard movie to watch, and I feel like in the form I saw it, the 122-minute cut, I feel like it doesn't quite click into place until the second hour, and when it does, it's unbelievably powerful. But I know it's coming out on Blu-ray January 14th, and there's a director's cut that's about actually 3 hours long. And what I've heard is it actually, some of the content I've heard that has been added and altered would actually fix not so much problems I had with the movie, but enhance it in ways I kind of wish it had been enhanced initially. So I'm really excited to see that cut, because that version of it could have placed even higher for me. But if you haven't seen The Act of Killing, definitely check it out. Very hard movie to watch, but absolutely fascinating, and definitely will be studied in documentary film classes for eternity. That was one of those movies I watched, and I'm like, yeah, this is going to be in film classes. Because I took a documentary film class recently, and it's one of those movies that will be in there. Deservingly, too, not like a Michael Moore documentary, which we shouldn't teach because they're stupid. Anyway.
All right, then.
Had you ever heard of this movie?
Yes.
Okay.
Because you talked about it before.
I did.
Yes.
That's so interesting. Okay. Yes. Number 8 is 12 Years a Slave, Steve McQueen's latest movie about Solomon Northrup, a free black...
Your list is just composed of all these really happy, lighthearted romps, you know?
Yes. I'm looking down the list. Yeah, oh my god, we've got a lot left.
Really should have put Thor 2 somewhere just to lighten up the fucking thing.
Honestly, the top 5 are lighter than the bottom 5, but we'll get into that. Alright, no, 12 Years a Slave, story of Solomon Northrup, free black man, pre-Civil War North. He's fairly prosperous, middle class, plays the violin, has a family. He gets kidnapped and sold into slavery in the South. Obviously, as the title implies, spends 12 years as a slave before being sent back to the North. Fantastic film. And Steve McQueen, if you haven't seen his previous work, the movies are Hunger and Shame. Shame was my number one film of the year for 2011, and I think it's one of the best movies of the 2000s so far. 12 Years a Slave doesn't quite hit that same level for me, but boy, did few movies this year leave me this deeply shaken, because 12 Years a Slave takes a story that this story could have been told wrong. It could have been told in an emotionally manipulative way, in a really saccharine way, where they like maybe keep cutting back to his wife and kids or something like that. Like, I can imagine the bad Hollywood version of this, and this is so not that movie. This is Steve McQueen working like he always has. The filmmaking is very controlled. It's very calm. It's very still. Mostly comprised of long takes, very few edits. More edits than in his previous movies, just because you have to have montage to illustrate 12 years. But absolutely fantastic. The acting, particularly by Chiwetel Ejiofor as Solomon Northrup, one of the best performances of this year. Absolutely a study in not underplaying, but subtlety and real humanist acting. But so many great performances. You have Michael Fassbender going full-on evil and gross, but also in an evil human way in this movie, as sort of the worst of the slave owners Solomon is subjected to. And you have Benedict Cumberbatch in a really great small role. Lupita Nyong'o is kind of the new star out of this movie. She plays a fellow slave that Solomon is introduced to, and she's fantastic. I haven't seen her in anything before. This may be her film debut, but she's just terrific in it. Great score by Hans Zimmer, even though the theme is the theme from Inception. Great cinematography by Sean Bobbitt, who's a really good cinematographer. It's great all around. I love the way it's constructed. There just is something... I think the calm with which it is told is really what makes it hit as hard as it does. And that it doesn't... It's completely unflinching of the horrors of this situation, but it also doesn't go overboard, and it isn't manipulative and schlocky. It just hits the exact perfect note on this story, and I think the highest praise I can give it is that this is as challenging as material comes for storytelling, and I can't imagine anyone telling it better than this. So, really great movie. If you haven't seen it, still in theaters, check it out. Good movie.
All right.
You may have to go see Thor 2 afterwards to even yourself out. But yes, number seven. This is called Stories We Tell, Sarah Pauli's documentary, which came out this year. This was my favorite documentary of this year, one of my favorite documentaries ever. It's another one that's very hard to explain because it's fairly high concept. Basically, Sarah Pauli, who's made some fiction films before, this is her first feature-length documentary. This is basically a film about her family, where she sets up interviews in sort of the traditional talking head interview style, very... maybe Errol Morrissey in a lot of ways, with her family. And she's talking to them about basically their past and about their mother. And at first, you don't quite know where this is going, but it ultimately becomes this story about sort of this familial intrigue. The mother had an affair. They're not sure if Sarah is her father's son or not. All this stuff comes out. It's a very personal story. But what makes it so universal and so interesting is the way it deconstructs documentary and cinematic form as it goes along. And the ways, in the end, it also becomes this story about storytelling, about the act of storytelling, about how families build stories together, about how relationships are forged by the way we remember things, about perception. It's about so many things. I think one of the things I said in all of my blurbs on all 10 of these movies is I think they're really rich and they're really dense with content, and Stories We Tell really exemplifies that. But honestly, for me, it's the most basic level, just the story of this family, and I think some of the specific revelations they come to about the nature of family and familial love and stuff, that hit me really hard. It's a really good universal story about that, just beautifully told. Honestly, it's one you can't describe, you just have to see. It's out on DVD now, and absolutely one of the best movies of the year. Had you heard about this one?
No, not at all.
Yeah, most people have not, which is a shame. It's a really, really great movie.
Yeah, but I also like, documentaries tend not to, get a lot of...
No, they don't, and that's too bad. There were a lot of good documentaries this year, honestly, that I didn't get to, and I feel kind of bad about. But Active Killing and Stories We Tell, boy, that's this good year for documentaries just out of those two, because those two are landmarks to me. So number six is a movie that none of you will have been able to see so far. It comes out in February. It's called The Wind Rises. Hayao Miyazaki's final film, animated. This came out in Japan over the summer, played in L.A. for 1 week. Critics got to see it, but it comes out, as I said, in February in dubbed and subtitled forms in American theaters, and absolutely check it out. The Wind Rises is Miyazaki's final film, and absolutely feels like it. It's a very clear and very reflexive final work for him. He brings together all the major themes of his career into this one movie. It's basically about the nature of artistry and creativity in a world that maybe not stifles it. That's like the cliche way to say this. Really what he's exploring is what artistry means in a world where when it goes out into the world, it may mean and something else, take on a different meaning. Mm-hmm. And if you've read like his essays and stuff, this is a big deal for Miyazaki because he obviously works in a very heavily commercialized industry. And yet he is fairly anti-commercial himself in his films and in his themes.
Yeah.
And so I think that dichotomy has been in his work before. You've seen it in films, going back to films like Nausicaa, to Princess Mononoke, specifically in how you reconcile life in a very complex and dark world. And The Wind Rises has those themes too. But it all comes together really beautifully in this movie, which is the semi-true story of Jiro Horikoshi, who is the man who invented the Zero Fighter, which was Japan's famous fighter plane from World War II. It was the plane used to attack Pearl Harbor. For this reason, the film has been controversial.
Yeah.
Pretty much everywhere it's come out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the point. I think Miyazaki was very, very knowledgeable that this is not necessarily a popular subject.
Yeah.
And he And I think it's also intentional that this portrait of Jiro Horikoshi is rather glowing. It's obviously fictionalized, for one. Most of it is... This is a fictionalized telling of that story. But I think it is intentional because the main theme and the idea of creativity and creative urges and artistic urges versus real-world application, that's a complex subject, and it's something that I think needs to be talked about more. And I think The Wind Rises is a great conversation starter on that level, because its basic argument is that art needs to exist and artistic urges need to be acted upon, but what they are later used for, in the case of the Zero Fighter, used as a kamikaze plane, involved many, many deaths. That's obviously a really complex idea, and I don't think it's something the film comes firmly down on. It's something it wants you to think about, but it's a complexity that needs to be addressed. And I think that's great that Miyazaki kind of leaves his career on that ambiguous note, because that to me is so central to so much of his work, that kind of ambiguity of life and this balance between pessimism about humanity and this also optimism for the nice things in our world, like art and like nature. So Wind Rises, great movie. It's got maybe the best animation of his career, which is really saying something, but it is absolutely stunningly animated, so much so that you really can't separate any discussion of the film and its themes from the artwork. Great score by Joe Hisaishi, great voice work by all the actors. I've seen the Japanese version, the dub is, you know, not done yet. Absolutely terrific film, so really check it out when it comes out. Definitely one of the best films of 2013.
Yeah. They announced the dubcast, right? Like, it's they got some celebrity stuff.
Mostly celebrities. I'm going to see it because I'm interested. It's Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Jiro Horikoshi. And that's interesting to me because Jiro is voiced by Hideaki Anno in Japanese, who is 55, 60. Mm-hmm. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is not that old. Yeah, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you know, is 30. And Jiro, in most of the movie, is about that age range. So I see the logic of it, but I think there's a specific reason they have an older voice actor doing it in Japanese. But I'm interested to hear that. I'm interested to hear Emily Blunt as the main female lead. That sounds like good casting. There is a genius stroke of casting in this movie, though.
Yeah, what is it?
There's a very mysterious character in the original Japanese version named Castorp. Wonderful character. He's in, like, a couple scenes. Very great, sort of mysterious, like, deep Japanese voice. You know the type.
Yeah.
They have hired Werner Herzog to do that voice. And that is genius.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome. So, I'm excited to hear it. You know, Disney has a hit-and-miss track record with Ghibli dubs. There are some great ones, and there are some Ponyo ones. So let's hope...
Fucking Liam Neeson in that movie.
Yeah, so hopefully this will not be a Ponyo one. But anyway, yeah. That when that comes out, I think either way you see it, it'll be good. I'm sure they're even doing this under the Touchstone banner, so they don't have to be... They don't have to Disney-fy it, which is probably good, because this movie is very adult in a lot of ways.
Yeah, like thinking about it, it doesn't quite translate to a Disney sort of thing the way, like, Totoro might, you know?
No, not at all. Yeah. I mean, they're smoking in every scene of the movie, because it's very period accurate in those ways. So, yeah, very, very good movie, though. Obviously, it's my number 6 film of the year. Yeah.
So I thought it was a piece of shit, but then I realized, oh, it's on this list.
Yeah. Number 6 is Edgar Wright's The World's End, the capper to the Three Flavors Cornetto trilogy that he made with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. The World's End, I mean, the Three Flavors Cornetto films, which previously are Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, two of my favorite movies of all time. I think Shaun of the Dead, I rewatched it because I saw The World's End first in a marathon screening of the trilogy, and that was a great way to do that, and it really highlighted how great these movies are, but especially highlighted for me just how much Shaun of the Dead does dramatically. It's not a comedy to me at all. It's got very funny parts, but that movie is completely and totally a straight zombie movie, and it uses the zombie form in the way, you know, George Romero would want you to, which is to analyze real issues.
Yeah.
And it's Shaun of the Dead is just a great movie, great character study, and I think The World's End absolutely lives up to that on the other side of things, where it is even darker than that. The ideas it's exploring in The World's End are very heavy. And I think The World's End is extremely funny. It's funnier than Shaun of the Dead. Probably not as funny as Hot Fuzz, which is the straight-faced comedy of the trio. The World's End is very funny. It's got an ingenious setup where they're doing this pub crawl back in... Basically, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost are, again, the main characters. But there are some other main characters in this one, played by Paddy Considine, Eddie Marsan, and the great Martin Freeman, who had a good year with between Bilbo and New Sherlock, and I guess that's 2014 now, but Martin Freeman's a great actor.
Yeah, and, fucking love Martin Freeman.
And he's great in The World's End. But yeah, these five friends who used to go to college together or lived in this hometown had this pub crawl when they were kids. Now Simon Pegg, who plays the character's Gary King. Gary King is basically a suicidal loser now in middle age, and he's trying to recapture his former glory by doing this pub crawl again, which only he thinks is cool, basically, at this point. Mm. And so it explores a lot of issues relating to, obviously, nostalgia and middle age, but even more than that, I think it's... And the finale has thrown a lot of people for a loop, because the ending of this movie, I think, is very intentionally challenging. But what it really is about, to me, is about... It's questioning whether or not humanity's sort of insatiable urge for individuality, whether or not that is, in fact, a good thing. And I think the answer it comes to is kind of shocking in its pessimism, but also completely earned. And especially when you look over this trilogy, I think the complex ways it takes some of the same themes of growing up and aging and brings them all together in The World's End is fascinating to me. And I think it is one of the most thematically rich films that came out this year, and one of the smartest films that came out this year. It's also one of the funniest, and it's got absolute great characters. Simon Pegg, I think, should be nominated for Best Actor. He was on my ballot for the Denver Film Critics Society nominations, because I think he's just stupendous in this movie. And if you look at all of the movies in the trilogy, he really isn't giving comedic performances in any of them. He is funny because he's a naturally funny guy, but they're very dramatic, very well-observed characters he's built, and none more so than Gary King. I think this is his best performance ever. It's absolutely fantastic. And the way that character grows and is kind of torn apart by the end of the movie is fascinating. And yet it's also got that same energy Edgar Wright brings to everything he does. So, you know, as the movie builds and they have to get to these 12 pubs, the pace of the movie is just perfect, and the insanity it raises too. And the drunker these characters get, the better they are at fighting the aliens that involve in this film, but also the better they are at opening up and being kind of torn apart, and it's really interesting in those ways. And it is absolutely a straight science fiction film, and it uses science fiction as it should be used, which is to talk about, you know, human issues in a very honest and direct way. And it's just a great movie, one of the great science fiction films in recent memory, and I think it really solidifies the Three Flavors Cornetto trilogy, as ridiculous as that sounds, as I think a very significant event in modern world cinema. And you know, I love all these movies, and The World's End I love just as much as the other two, and I think it's going to be one of my favorite movies in life going forward. So definitely one of the best films of 2013. Number four is Short Term 12. This is a movie, the independent film, came out in August. I missed it because it was just kind of under my radar. I had heard good things about it, and then I heard more good things about it after it was out of theaters, and that's always a tough position to be in. Was able to get a screener at the end of the year, and boy, this movie blew me away. Short Term 12 takes place in a basically in-between home for troubled youths, where they don't have parents anymore, or their parents are not fit to be parents, but they don't have foster care yet. It's this in-between home, that's why it's, you know, short term. And it focuses on basically the head of this short-term living space. She's played by Brie Larson, and at first she seems like the most in-control human being you could ever know, because she is so good at her job, so good at working with these kids, knows exactly... She's very strategic. I love watching Brie Larson act in the beginning of this movie, because she's just piecing together these situations to figure out exactly how to tackle them, and it's really interesting. And as the movie goes along, eventually revealed that she is really as troubled as the kids she works with. And I think what the movie winds up saying in exploring her character and in exploring the characters of these kids is that, you know, it's absolutely okay to be damaged, and it's absolutely okay to have these difficulties. And how we work through those as humans is through our capacity for empathy, and that is really the greatest... I think what the movie's saying is that's really the greatest thing you can ever do for another human being is empathize with them and be there for them when they need that. And it seems like a very simple message, but I think the specific way Short Term 12 dissects that and analyzes that and how it doesn't pull any punches. It's very, very dark. It's completely unflinching in dealing with the kinds of things that happen for foster care youths in the United States. But then building up to, I think, a very optimistic core. And I think optimism for me can only be earned when you also see the flip side of that coin. And to me, that's what makes Short Term 12 such a miraculous movie, is that it can have that level of optimism for the darkness of what it's working with. And, I mean, we've seen so many versions of this story that are just shitty after-school specials.
Yeah.
You know, someone working with kids. This is so not that. And so much of that goes to Brie Larson, who I think is probably giving easily my favorite performance of the year among female performers. I would absolutely give her Best Actress this year, and I was happy to see the Denver Film Critics Society nominations came out and managed to get her on the ballot for that, so I'm happy about that. But really, really great movie. It comes out on Blu-ray January 14th. Definitely check it out if you haven't. One of the great films of this year, and one of the surprises, because it just, you know, it was kind of under the radar for a lot of people. I think critics saw it. I don't think it had any real public traction, and that's too bad. But really a great movie.
Cool.
Number three is one, Sean, you're going to want to check out.
Okay.
This is Inside Llewyn Davis.
Yes.
This is the fucking Coen brothers.
Yeah, I still have not managed to see it yet.
And
I
just as no one makes a Martin Scorsese movie like Martin Scorsese, nobody makes a Coen brothers movie like the Coen brothers.
That is fucking true.
And the great thing about the Coen brothers is that what constitutes a Coen brothers movie?
Yeah, I can't answer that fucking question.
I can't put it in writing, but when you see it, you know it.
Yeah.
And so Inside Llewyn Davis is not, it's not a crazy comedy like The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
It's not super dark and quiet like No Country for Old Men. But it's absolutely a Coen brothers movie because it is this great study of a period. It's about, if you don't know, it's 1960s Greenwich Village. Llewyn Davis is this aspiring folk singer who basically is in the last week of his career. His career is failing. He is going to have to get out or not have a future, basically. And that's something only the Coen brothers would explore. Yeah. Because if you know their work, even in their funniest stuff like The Big Lebowski, I think there is an underlying kind of darkness to it, but a darkness that is very real. Not just dark for the sake of being dark. I think they're, you know, they know the difficulties of being human, basically.
Yeah.
And to me, Llewyn Davis is absolutely about that within the context of art. And it is about how, you know, art is something that lives within us. It's something, if you have an artistic instinct, it's not something you can change. It's not something you can repress. And if it doesn't kind of work in the world, as it does for Llewyn Davis, he cannot get people to, you know, he's a good folk singer, but he's not commercial in a sense, basically. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do that, you can't adjust your artistry. You can't be something you're not. And I think that's what this movie is exploring, is how can you not be something you're not and also fail, and how do you reconcile these ideas? And yet, at the same time, it's a very funny movie. It's one of the funniest movies the Coens have ever made. It's one of the funniest movies this year, but in a very organic, character-based way. And I think, overall, it is that dramatic side that hit me, this idea of artistic failure and the idea of feeling, more than anything else, artistically spent. Those moments in your life, if you do anything artistic, where you feel like you have nothing else left to give, like you've given everything. And that's so much what Oscar Isaac is playing in Llewyn Davis in this movie. And Oscar Isaac also giving one of the great performances of this year. I'm also a big fan of folk music and the 1960s Greenwich Village scene. It's kind of, you know, one of my passions in music and stuff. So this movie very clearly plays to my own interests a lot. I mean, this may be my favorite Coen brothers movie just in terms of how much I love the period they're using. But I also think it is just, you know, on a technical level, on a writing level, on a direction level, it's as good as anything they've ever done. But really, really great in all those ways. Oscar Isaac is awesome in this movie. He's just fantastic. But you've also got Carey Mulligan giving a wonderfully angry performance. You've got John Goodman, who the Coen brothers continue to prove no one can use John Goodman as well as the Coens.
Yeah.
And really, John Goodman should just be in Coen brothers movies.
Because John Goodman should just be in everything, is what I think.
But that's the thing.
But he should especially be in Coen brothers movies.
That's the thing, is I think in the last 20 years or so, a lot of people have used John Goodman poorly. I think the Coen brothers, when they use him, they know how to use him. And he's only in this movie for about half an hour, but that half hour is fantastic. Just so many great performances, so much great music in the movie. This is something I love about this movie, is that when someone performs a song, they let that whole performance go. They don't cut off 30 seconds in. Because that's character development. If these are musicians, you need to see them doing what they do. And they really know how to do that.
Which is mostly, you know, cocaine and hookers. But
right. Well, this is early 60s, Sean. We're not quite there yet.
Okay, so acid. Yeah.
Right. Anyway, so, yes. If you're a Coen Brothers fan, this is a must-see. But especially, I think, if you like that folk music scene and are interested in it, this is one of the great studies of that. But also just of artistry, as I said, and it's a great character study overall. It's so creative. Really, really love this movie. The top three placements, I should say, were in a virtual tie for number one, and it was kind of hard to break them out. But that's number three. Number two is Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity. I've talked about this before on the podcast.
I've talked about it before on the podcast.
Sean has. This is the only movie on the list you've seen, right?
Yep.
Okay. Well, I love Gravity, and I think it's absolutely one of the great technical accomplishments in cinematic history. Yeah. Nothing else looks like Gravity. No movie has ever captured space and the experience of being in space this well since 2001 A Space Odyssey, and Gravity is allowed to go even further with that. And I feel, and I think a lot of people who love this movie, I think the easiest way to say why Gravity works as well as it does is that I think all those technical accomplishments and everything it does on a special effects level is all in service of a really profound and well-done character story. And whether or not that character story hits you, I think that's absolutely what Alfonso Cuarón is trying to do here. And I think it operates on two levels. One, I think it's the allegory of space in this movie. The allegory is basically this... I have to use the word space in two ways here. But the space I think people exist in after a loss, I think, is where Sandra Bullock is in this movie. And it's a very broad allegory in how it's used here. But that's basically what we're seeing here in this movie, is this idea of someone who is ungrounded after a loss, emotionally lost. And that's kind of what space represents. There is no life in space. There is no life in that emotional middle zone, basically, that she exists in, and that I think anyone who has experienced loss knows what that feels like. And definitely Gravity came along at the right time to hit me in that way, and I had a very profound emotional experience watching this movie. But I think as it goes along, and that movement from that space back into the space of life, it's a very simple emotional arc, but it's a very profound one. And you are now hearing my cell phone going off, and I'm letting it on the radio because that's the TARDIS ringtone I got.
Yeah, see, I thought that was mine because that's my text tone. Although nice. My text tone is a lot shorter.
Okay. I'm going to silence my phone, but we're Doctor Who fans here, so, you know, it's okay letting everyone know I have a TARDIS ringtone, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And turn that shit off. Anyway, Gravity.
Right, yeah. So then the Doctor materializes in space and picks up Sandra Bullock.
And saves her, and she becomes his new companion.
That's the end of the movie.
Yeah, no, I think Sandra Bullock is fantastic in this movie. Really, really great performance. The movie is on her shoulders, and I think it works as well as it does because she carries it. George Clooney is really good in his couple of scenes. I really love his last scene in the movie in particular. I think that's a great sequence. And it's so perfectly paced. 90 minutes, gets in, gets out. Just so intense. It's very experiential. But again, I think all that experience is towards an emotional and philosophical point that absolutely sums up my own personal beliefs on the world and on life. And that's part of why I love it as much as I do. But I think it's absolutely a masterpiece. I think it's something that's going to endure, and I think it's going to endure because of its narrative and thematic accomplishments, not just because of its special effects accomplishments. So that's why Gravity is at number two. And my number one film of the year is Spike Jonze's Her. It stars Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson. Joaquin Phoenix stars as a man, Theodore Twombly, who is sort of sad and lonely, but not pathetic, and that's something I love that this movie does. It does not make its characters out to be pathetic because they are sad or lonely. But he's sad and lonely after his wife has divorced him, and this happens in sort of a near-future sci-fi landscape where there's this new operating system that he gets. It's kind of... people have compared it to Siri. That's not at all what they're doing in this movie. That's actually a really strange comparison to me. But it's basically this intelligent operating system that he gets and lives
with. Yeah, it's nothing like Siri if it has any degree of intelligence.
Exactly. Like, that's my point, though. Siri, like, you talk to it and it can give you directions, I guess. That's really not the kind of idea they're going for here.
Yeah, Siri is just a voice interface. That's all.
Yeah, that's all, yeah. This is artificial intelligence. It's this artificial intelligence named Samantha, voiced by Scarlett Johansson, and he winds up falling in love with her. And boy, if that isn't one of the strangest dumb premise to great movie ratios I've ever seen, where you don't hear that and instinctively think that's going to make a great movie.
It just seems like a bad decision with your love life to start pursuing a bodiless AI, but you know, that's just me.
No, but her is the rawest movie that came out this year to me. It is in the confessional voice. It is... the entire movie is this series of emotional purgings by the characters, and I think the filmmaker through them, about love and about loss and about loneliness and about human connections and about what we want out of life and out of other people. And I think, to me, what hit me so hard with her and how I knew probably an hour into this movie that this was the best movie that came out this year. And I'm not even saying that in the term favorite. I don't know what my favorite movie that came out here this year was. I do know that Her was the best to me because I think the level of performance, for one, by Joaquin Phoenix one of the great performances I've ever seen, let alone in 2013. The level of work he has to do to make this character and the movie that he is carrying work is incredible. And the same can be said of Scarlett Johansson in a voice role. This is a very demanding voice role, and she does a phenomenal job with it, and the chemistry she creates with Joaquin Phoenix, after the fact, because she did not record this with him, is terrific. But then the specific writing, the script by Spike Jonze, and the ideas it explores, and how raw it allows everything to be, and how scenes are allowed to go on to the point... You know, there's a point in most movies about relationships and about life where people are talking in this tone where scenes cut. And, you know, you get to kind of that emotional crescendo and they cut. Mm-hmm. And you go on to something else. Her doesn't cut. It lets it go past that point because that's where the real reality of these characters exists. And it's where the real reality of these emotions exists. And so there's just these great emotional confessional scenes that happen over and over again. And it's really powerful. And yet at the same time, I think it says something so profound about relationships and about breakups. And, we, you know, that's a common topic in movies, is breakups and relationships and things. But I think Her is so clear-eyed about it in that it doesn't wallow in sadness so much as it comes to this place of beauty, where the ultimate point of the movie is this affirmation of human connection. And whether it lasts forever or whether it lasts briefly, it's meaningful. And that's why you have to have this relationship between this artificial intelligence and between Theodore Twombly, because that's a connection that means something. It's completely unconventional. It doesn't make any sense. And yet it really is meaningful, and this and it explores a lot more ideas about the nature of humanity and whatnot through this artificial intelligence side of things. Although in a way, I haven't seen a sci-fi film tackle those ideas before. But really, I just think the idea that the ways it explores human emotions and human capacity for emotions and for relationships and connections and friendships and all these things is really terrific. It's also got stupendous production design, really beautiful cinematography. It's not a bleak sci-fi landscape. In fact, it's the kind of sci-fi film where it's not afraid of its own ideas. And I've seen way too many sci-fi films in my life that are afraid of the future.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of sick of that at this point. Like, there's this movie, Wally Feister, Christopher Nolan's cinematographer, is making this movie called Transcendence with Johnny Depp, where Johnny Depp, like, is dying and he uploads his consciousness to the cloud and then he becomes evil and tries to destroy the world. I don't have any interest in that movie whatsoever because I'm done seeing sci-fi stories where we have to be scared of everything and the future is bleak and bad. I think Her is interesting because it looks at the upsides and downsides and the honest upsides and downsides of this idea of an intelligent operating system you could share your life with. Because there absolutely would be good points to that.
Yeah, before they, you know, take over the world and enslave us and use our bodies as batteries. Yeah.
Yeah, except Isaac Asimov, as he's set down, that would not happen.
Yeah.
Except in the movie they made.
Yeah, I mean, we'd be dead before we develop an artificial intelligence anyways. We're not going to survive that long, so
okay,
it's pointless. Like, it's you know, it's speculative fiction that's not going to...
Right, yeah. But this is great speculative fiction. And Her, absolutely the best movie of the year for me. Putting it at number one felt right from the moment I saw it. And so, yeah, it comes out January 10th wide. I think it's still only playing in New York and L.A. See it when it comes out. See it on the big screen. I have only gotten to see it on DVD so far, and I'm really excited to see it in theaters because it has that just level of cinematography. The music by Arcade Fire is so great. I'm going to talk about this with some of my favorite games of the year, too, but I got to the end of this movie, and it wasn't like I was having this big emotional release like I felt I had with Gravity or About Time. I just felt so calm and cleared and kind of artistically set to neutral because the movie had been so great, and I felt so clear-headed by it. And that, to me, is the greatest art does that. So, that's my top 10 movies of the year. Sean, yours is still Thor 2?
Yeah, that's my top 10 movie of the year.
Okay.
Yeah.
All of them, all 10 slots are Thor 2, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Okay.
Just Thor 2 all the way, and then, like, worst movies. And then my top 10 worst movies is just Man of Steel.
All the way.
And then at the bottom it just says, fuck you, Man of Steel.
Okay.
That's my number one, it's just fuck you, Man of Steel.
There were definitely worse movies this year than Man of Steel, and that's...
Not if you're me.
Okay.
Not if you're a big fan of Superman like
well,
I am,
Man of Steel,
in that way.
Man of Steel was in my top 30, so was Thor 2, and yeah. I mean, man, for pure entertainment value, Thor 2 is up there.
Yes.
That was pretty great.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see that movie again.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on. Sean, you want to talk about some video games?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm fucking here. I don't know what we've been talking about for, like, the last hour. I've just been spacing out and thinking about Thor 2.
Okay, so Sean, this was a good year in games?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, so we've each made a top 10. They're very similar, because we have similar tastes in games.
Yes.
I borrowed all the
games. Yeah, and then, like, you know, we don't have enough time to play 50 games in 1 year, right, where you could feasibly do that with movies, you know.
Yeah, I saw, you know, well over 100 movies this year. I did not play well over 100 games.
Yeah, because also games are fucking expensive.
Yes.
So, yeah.
But, like, how did you do your list? Like, what were kind of your principles on
it? Well, it was actually really interesting because, you know, for people who've been listening for a while, you might remember last year when we did our end of the year podcast, my game of the year thing there was only 5. Well, kind of only 5.
But, and the year before it was only 5 also. Yeah,
because when I make these lists, I like them to be, like, competitive in some way. I don't want... Because with games, like, usually I only play, like, 10 new games in a year because it's like that's all you really have the time and money for. And so I don't want it just to be the list of games I played that year. I want it to be the best games I played that year. So I started out making the list a top 5 games list, and then I made it, and I was like, it did not sit right with me at all because there were just too many really good and especially just really remarkable games that was like, I can't fit all of them on my top 5 games list, so I have to expand it out. So, and there were, then I did play more games this year than I gave myself credit for. Like, my total games played was like 18. The total games finished was probably like 15 or 14.
Yeah, I had a similar experience.
Yeah.
Where I at first was not planning to make a list and just let Sean talk and I talk on the games I played on. And then I started just listing all the games I'd played. I'm like, I played more than I realized for one.
Yeah.
And then I spent the last couple weeks catching up on some games, like indie titles in particular. Those are easy to catch up on.
Yeah.
And we had the Steam sale. Mm-hmm. So that was really helpful. So I caught up on some games. I tried making a top 5 and it was the same thing. It's like, this is not going to be the most competitive top 10 in the world.
Yeah.
But if I don't have all 10 of these games on a list, I would feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
I would feel kind of sad because I couldn't talk about them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I think looking at both of our lists, this was a darn good year for indie games.
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, that's sort of been going on for a while now, and it just keeps on getting better and better, where a lot of the best games that come out each year are, luckily for us, these small, focused, and cheaper titles. Yes. That it's like, you can play a game in, like, one sitting. Like, there are several games on this list that I completed in just one sitting. That was not a crazy, like, marathon sitting like I do with, like, a Halo campaign. That was just, this is, like, 2 to 3 hours long. I just sit down, play the whole thing, have a phenomenal time. And the best part about the indie games tends to be that they have, like, that singular creative vision that most big-budget games don't have because they have, you know, staff like 1,000 people worked on. I mean, over 1,000 people literally worked on Assassin's Creed 4. So right. It's like, that's not going to have this focused, like, intense, emotional, creative direction that is this, like, massive game made by committee, you know? So, yeah, like, the indie games revolution is still going on, and it's getting more and more impressive as it goes.
Yeah, absolutely. So, one of the things I wanted to talk about before we get started is just, because gaming, it's so different than movies, because everyone generally has access to the same movies. We don't all have access to the same games. Sure. If we have different consoles, money can be a bigger issue here.
But you meant, like, if you're, like, in a country where, like, this game didn't come out. No. It's like, I mean, yeah, but that doesn't seem significant.
But I'm saying, you don't need to go have a specific theater to see a movie. Like, you need a specific console.
I mean, it depends on the,
I guess,
the movie.
Yeah.
Like, some movies don't come out everywhere.
That's true. But either way, I just wanted to ask, what games this year did you not play that you really wanted to? Because I have a couple that I feel bad about.
Oh, I wish I had thought about that before you asked the question. Like, Tomb Raider was one. Like, Tomb Raider probably wouldn't have been on the list, just from what I know about it, but I wanted to play Tomb Raider a lot. There's that Devil May Cry reboot that came out at the very, very beginning of the year that
it's coming out on PS Plus. Yeah,
that I always wanted to get around to, never really did, because everything I heard about that game sounded really, really interesting. But actually, I did end up playing basically everything I really wanted to.
Okay.
Like, everything that seemed really massively significant. But you clearly have given this some thought, so
I have more thought.
Some ideas that's not coming up in my head right now.
I did it as a top 5, okay, totally arbitrarily, but yeah, the number one game I wish I had played this year was...
Oh, I know,
Was Super Mario 3D World for the Wii U. I don't want to own a Wii U, but I love Mario, and this game got such good reviews, and it looked so cool. And I was skeptical about it at first. I talked about it on this podcast. This game did not look good to me. I really wish I had played it, because I think it probably would have been on my top 10, just knowing how much I love what they've been doing with Mario lately in his main games, not like Mario Party 9.
Yeah.
Number 2 for me is Fire Emblem Awakening.
Yeah, that is one that, if I had, yeah, like, I wasn't thinking about 3DS titles, but that and Legend of Zelda Link Between Worlds. I would have liked to have played both of those, but I don't have a 3DS.
Right, and I do have a 3DS, so I guess I have no excuse, except that 3DS games...
you're an asshole.
Except 3DS games are fucking expensive, and they never come down in price, and you can't get them used, and so you either pay your $40 or you don't, and it's...
Hey, guess what? Fire Emblem Awakening, that would be worth $40.
I'm sure it would be, but it's just, it's something that I was kind of thinking about this recently, where Steam, you never have to pay full price.
Yeah.
PlayStation, I don't ever play full price. Xbox, at this point, you don't ever need to pay full price. Nintendo, you have no goddamn option. You pay the $40 or you don't. So anyway, not a complaint about Fire Emblem specifically. I wish I had played this game. 3 for me was Tomb Raider, and I do have the PS4 version on pre-order, and I'm excited to play it, because...
the Definitive Edition.
Yes.
Which I think is the best name for, like, a Game of the Year... version of a game. This is the Definitive Edition of Tomb. All you people who played Tomb Raider before, fuck you. You played this watered ass down bullshit version of Tomb Raider. This is the definitive fucking Tomb Raider.
With next gen hair effects, Sean.
Exactly. Goddamn Tress effects, motherfucker.
No, and I actually own Tomb Raider on PS3.
So it's weird that it's on this list.
I bought it for $1, though, and I never got around to playing it, so I'm just going to play the PS4 version because then I can use the DualShock 4.
Yeah, and then, you know, Tress effects, motherfucker.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I sold Tomb Raider for a fucking profit. I got my PS3 copy sold for $20 yesterday.
Nice.
So that is pure profit. I paid $1 for that game. Anyway, number 4 for me was Brothers: A Tale of Two Sons, which we may be talking about soon.
Maybe it might be on a list somewhere.
And the only, I honestly would have played that before the end of the year. The only reason I didn't is it's on PlayStation Plus next month.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So gonna get it for free. And number 5 for me, because this one looked cool.
Yeah,
and it's also coming out on PS Plus tomorrow. Don't Starve.
Yeah,
I'm excited to play that.
Yeah, I've got it on because it came out on PC a while ago. And I played it there. It's a pretty good game.
Okay, it's coming out on PS4 even, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, all
right. Anything else? Any honorable mentions for you?
Not really. And,
okay.
Like, well, there would be one, but it's on your list, so
okay.
I don't need to talk about it yet.
Wonderful. All right, so Sean, why don't you get us started with your number 10?
Okay, my number 10 game of the year is Rezogun. Rezogun, or however you do choose. I've talked to other people about this game, and they called it Rezogun.
It's Rezogun.
Yeah, it's not pronounced Rezogun, you fucking maniacs. There's only one E. But, yeah, so Rezogun, you know, this was one of the free titles that came with PlayStation Plus with the PlayStation 4. And usually, I was really surprised that I liked this game this much, because usually I don't sort of buy into the whole sort of our, like, new arcade game thing, you know? Like, I'm not a huge fan of Geometry Wars and that kind of game. But there's something about Rezogun that, like, I tried it out a couple of times. It didn't quite click. Mostly because Rezogun is immensely complex. Like, it is not Geometry Wars in the sense of, like, Geometry Wars, you play it for, like, a second and you immediately understand, you fly around and shoot shit, and there's a little bit more going on, but that's basically it. The Rezogun, it's like, you have, like, the humans, like, how the humans appear and stuff like that. Like, that takes
the keepers.
Yeah, the keepers.
Your own guns and stuff?
Yeah, and how your guns upgrade all the, like, you like bombs and boosting and shields and, like, throwing dudes into the capture places and stuff like that. Like, how you make the boss appear by just killing enemies. Like, none of that shit's explained. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on with Rezogun. But then once you figure it out and it clicks, the game is so much fun to play. And especially when you play it on the harder difficulties, it is immensely challenging, but immensely satisfying when you get it down. Because you have so many tools at your disposal compared to most of these kinds of games. Where it's not just flying and shooting. You have the bombs, you have like the whatever that like giant laser you shoot is called. But most critically, you have that boost. I think that boost is... so important to this game of that, like, it makes you invincible when you do it. So that adds this extra little element of this sort of, like, card, you know, up your sleeve that you have of, like, if you're in a tricky situation, you have a method to get out. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of the combat in these arcadey modern games lacks for me, is, like, it's so simple and so basic that there's not enough sort of, like, depth beyond just moving and shooting, that, like, knowing when and how to use your boost critically is an important factor to this game, and it creates a lot of depth into the combat for me. And I just found it's immensely addicting, and I fucking love playing it.
Yeah, Rezogun is on my list as well. I'll tell you where when we get to it, but I'll talk about it now. I think you hit the nail on the head. To me, Rezogun has one of the just best gameplay foundations of any game this year. And that gameplay foundation is so sturdy and so deep once you get into it that you can really lose yourself in the game. Yeah. Even though it's only 5 levels, and you've only got the 3 ships, it really is so fun to return to. And I always, every time I play my PS4, I wind up going and playing like 1 level of Resident Evil.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
usually failing, because I try to play it on Veteran and it's really hard.
Yeah, it is.
And it's, you know, but it's a really rewarding challenge. I feel like it's frustrating in the right way.
Yeah.
But yeah, more than anything else, it's just you have to praise it for having that just really flawless, well-done gameplay foundation, controls well, makes absolutely stunning use of the PS4's graphics yeah. quality. I mean, the particle effects in this game are just stunning. Mm-hmm. It's so nice to look at. I love the sound. I love kind of the retro voice that comes out of the controller.
Yeah.
Just, it's a really, really well-done version of what it's trying to be, and it's trying to be, as you said, kind of small and arcadey, but deep in the way you would want a modern arcade game
yeah.
to be.
Yeah.
So absolutely one of the best games of the year for me.
Yeah. And then one of the other things about it that I really, really love is how replayable it is, and specifically how different all 3 different ships play.
Yes.
Especially if you go from the really, really fast ship to the really slow ship with the powerful guns. Like, those play styles are so completely different, yeah. and it's so much fun, because it's like, especially the boss fights, the strategies are utterly different. Like, you cannot approach the boss fights the same way if you have the different ships at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And this was absolutely the killer app for me on the PS4 at launch.
Yeah. Because, yeah, as an exclusive, yes.
Yeah, I mean, the other 2 exclusives I got at launch were Knack and Killzone, and I gave up on both of them. They weren't interesting to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, Resogun has kept my attention and made me happy to have bought the console.
All right.
So my number 10 is an indie game called Proteus. Whether or not you can call it a game is up for debate.
Yeah.
Because it has... Well, and I think that's the thing, is that yeah. it's, you know, it's pushing and playing with those boundaries in a yeah. fun way. Proteus, it's for the PC, Mac, PS3, and Vita. I've played it on the Vita and PS3. And it's a very, very simple game in which, basically, there's an island.
Yeah.
It's colorful. It's randomly generated. All the sound is linked to what you see. Not in any real concrete way I can discern, but in ways that feel very sort of... Like, how you walk around and move, the music perfectly matches your movements.
Yeah, and then there's stuff like things in the environment, like when a frog jumps, it'll make a specific kind of sound.
Yes.
And they're like flowers that make noises when you walk through them and stuff like that.
Yeah, so I think the best way I've heard it described is an audiovisual forest wandering game. Which is basically
yeah.
what it is.
Yeah.
And there's no goal other than walking around and seeing things. And you progress the seasons. Basically, there are 4 seasons you move through. And then you go to heaven or something.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting ending that I really like. But the campaign, you know, if you can call it that.
The campaign,
A playthrough of,
yeah.
of Proteus is like 30 to 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's very short. But it also feels, and this is why it got on my top 10. And I honestly just wanted to play it because I heard it was really cool. But I didn't think it was going to make my top 10 or have this impact for me, but really it was just I sat down to play it on my Vita. It was late at night, I was tired and bleary-eyed, and time kind of went away on that first playthrough through me. I absolutely just kind of lost myself in exploring. The graphics are absolutely gorgeous, and you know, in a year where it was really cool to get next-gen consoles and see next-gen graphics, Proteus is a nice reminder that, you know, good art design is
yeah.
still so fundamental, because this is one of the most beautiful games
of the year. I think, for my money, I think Proteus is the best-looking game that came out this year.
Like, I think that's very
like,
possible.
It is... It just looks so cool.
I wanted to take screenshots of this more than games on the PS4,
yeah.
for instance. It was so beautiful. And I think you just wandering around and listening to the music, which is, this is also the kind of music I really love listening to sometimes, this kind of ambient, experimental, atonal,
yeah.
it's really interesting. And the way, you know, you don't even know what the music is so much. It plays with those boundaries. Is music just a collection of sounds, or is it something more? Because these sounds that you just encounter play into that music.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating. But anyway, when I played it, as I said, late at night, I just kind of lost myself in it. And I realized you don't so much play Proteus as you meditate with it.
Yeah.
You get into this very meditative stance. And honestly, it was so weird. It cleared my head. I got ideas for writing. I just felt so clear-headed after playing the game, and so calm and relaxed. Like, even, like, I felt like my muscles and joints were more relaxed. Like, I just, everything
yeah.
about the game made me feel different. And I think that level of impact it had, even though it's not something you can necessarily put into words, it's very ethereal, it was really fun. And I got, you know, I kind of recaptured it on a second playthrough, seeing a new version of the island. It was really fun. And I can just imagine returning to this game on bad days, or when I feel like I need to calm down or something. Like, this would be a great game just to kind of relax to.
Yeah.
And it's just so different than anything else I've played, and I think it has such a unique sort of response from the player, absolutely it had to be on my top 10 for me. It's very slight, it's very small, yeah. So that's why it's at number 10, but really creative use of the form.
Yeah, like Proteus might have been on my list, but honestly, like I played it when it came out on the PC, and I think it came out like right at the beginning
January
of this year.
30th, yeah.
Yeah, so it's been, so like I completely forgot that I had played it, but yeah. Like, I thought Proteus came out last year, but yeah, no, it is a really fucking cool thing. Like, yeah. it totally fits being on the list, but I don't want to call it a game because that feels like you're misdescribing it. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
It's purely just sort of experiential thing of just, like, and my favorite thing about Proteus was when I discovered that if you hit the space bar, you sit down, and so when I was on the island, like, I was just, like, kind of walking around, and then the sun was setting, I was on the beach, and I just kind of sat down and watched this frog hopping past my vision while, like, the sun set, and was like, this is fucking cool.
I love going to the tops of mountains and watching sunsets, and, you know, we talk a lot about choice in gaming. Proteus has a really, like, integral choice element to me, too, which is, I see this fork, there's something beautiful over there and beautiful over there, which one do I go
look at? Yeah, it's just like, there is a vague, like, sort of story, if you want to call it that, of, like, the seasons changing, which is, like, the most basic sort of symbolic metaphorical story ever told in human history that is just told in everything that is actually the basic format is used and like, played with in multiple games this year. But, yeah, the whole seasons thing and the way it changes and just how beautiful the game is, it's so utterly experiential that it's just, like, I just want to walk around. Like, I just want to see this island. And then, and again, just the game is so beautiful. My favorite thing about it is, like, the visual style. It's like you're living inside an Atari game. Like, it's just so amazing. It's so cool to see the way it looks and just wandering around that island. It's
literally,
like you said, it's so calm and relaxing in a way I've never seen with anything else.
Literally breathtaking sights.
Yeah.
Like when the stars come out or what happens at the end of a playthrough. It's really fascinating.
Proteus, so, fucking cool.
My number 10 game of the year. Sean, what is your number 9?
So this is, I like having, talking about Proteus and then talking about this, because it's just like complete fucking opposite scales.
Right.
Where Proteus is like made by one dude, is a small scale, really calm, relaxing, totally experiential game. And then my number 9 is Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell Blacklist, which is, you know, big, like the one I really like about this game is that it is, you know, AAA, like, is like the summer blockbuster movie of video games, of like, it's not necessarily hugely remarkable, you know, like, the characters aren't massively interesting, it's not doing anything hugely innovative or unique and, like, that you can't get anywhere else kind of thing, but what it does do with, like, just delivering heavy action in a really entertaining way, it does masterfully. It's, you know, it's like Die Hard in that way. It's like, you know, John McClane isn't, like, this fascinating character that you want to, like, dig into, and, like, Die Hard doesn't have these intense, like, emotional themes that you have to dissect and analyze. It's just a lot of fucking fun to watch, and Splinter Cell Blacklist is a lot of fucking fun to play, and I think the game has, you know, like, the action element of it is really, really enjoyable, and, you know, the plot is kind of throwaway, but it works for what it is. But the main thing about the game that I love is just how like many different approaches the game supports of how many different ways you can play it, and that you can go in totally, you know, guns blazing, just like grab a goddamn assault rifle and like just a shit ton of grenades, and getting incendiary grenades in this game is so much fun if you are a sadistic motherfucker like I am sometimes, and that when you know incendiary grenades, you fucking light people on fire. It's like napalm in a box, and so you just throw it at people and God damn it, can you light people on fire in this game? Like, it is fucking disturbing. But yeah, like, you can go that way and just be a crazy motherfucker with a gun and a box of napalm, or you can be, like, super sneaky, not kill, like, anybody other than, like, people who have to die, like, for the plot. Like, you can just sneak past every single room, EMP, you know, security cameras and that shit. You know, if you're a pussy, you can play the pussy way. Or if you want to be totally fucking badass, and this is the kind of the way I like to play these stealth games, is I really like this modern version of stealth where you can play extremely aggressively but be stealthy at the same time. Of that, how you approach a room is like, you go into a room, you see how all the people there, and you don't try to just sneak past them and go completely undetected, and you don't just go in like guns blazing, like balls out, kill everybody. You sneak around and you kill people like one at a time and lure people around corners and try to kill them all without being detected at the same time. So that's how I played Blacklist, and it's extremely satisfying just playing the sort of basically... It's one of the most fun sort of horde modes I've ever played, because it basically has a horde mode. And it's the only fun I've ever had on a horde mode playing alone, because it just creates this very organic combat puzzle that's different every single time you approach it, because it just drops you into these really, really well-constructed environments. Like, the levels are really masterfully made, and to support all those different approaches, and you just drop into one of those levels, and it keeps on spawning in dudes, and you have to figure out how to kill them. And then if you play on the harder difficulties, this game is also really, really fucking hard. Like, I remember there were several times when you would come over to record a podcast and I was playing this game, and I was... It's not necessarily a game you want to play before recording a podcast, because you get really fucking angry when the game will just throw, like, seven dudes covered in body armor who are really hard to take out, and you just, like, how the fuck am I supposed to do this? Like, how the fuck do you kill seven dudes with body armor when I've just got, like, my pistol and a knife? But the best thing about the game is that, like, you can do it. You can figure out. You just have to be clever and think outside the box, and you have so many tools at hand that there's always a way to tackle the situation in whatever way you want to. And so, yeah, Blacklist is so much fun to play. It's just really, really, really well-designed and very satisfying combat game.
Awesome. And, you know, I want to play this game sometime, because... Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell games have never interested me.
Yeah, like, I'm not a big fan of the old ones. That's something I should say, is that I'm not traditionally a big fan of stealth games. So, like, I know a lot of people sort of, like, thumb their noses at the previous Splinter Cell game and this one, because it's not, you know, like, super hardcore stealth like Chaos Theory. But I didn't like Chaos Theory, so.
Okay. So it's weird, because there's nothing that's ever appealed to me about this, but hearing you talk about it so highly, it must be fun.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of fucking fun.
Nice. So you played it on 360, right?
Yes.
Okay. Cool. So my number 9 game of the year is Batman Arkham Origins.
Yeah, this is when I said I would have had an honorable mention. This would have been it.
Okay. And Arkham Origins for me, yes, there are shortcomings. Yeah. WB Games Montreal took on one of the biggest mantles in modern AAA video gaming, because Rocksteady did such a phenomenal hit it out of the park job with Arkham City and Arkham Asylum. And I think they took that on, and there are ways in which they come up shorter. The specific, you know, Predator encounters, they're good, but they're not as good as they were in the Rocksteady games.
Yeah.
There are some fight encounters that are either too hard, or they minimalize it too much with things like shock gloves.
Yeah, I don't like the shock gloves.
There are things in the collectible areas that are a little too obscure. And I know for some people this game was glitchy. I had the great fortune of never really encountering glitches in this game. So I like it's hard to say. I can't complain about that, because it didn't happen to me.
Yeah, it definitely it totally locked out a side quest. Like, I haven't gone back to the game yet to see if a patch has fixed it, but it locked out one of the side quests for me. And then it's just like reading forums, there are a lot of people who encountered a lot of like utterly game breaking bugs.
And that's absolutely too bad. But I can only talk about my experience, and I didn't have that. And the experience I had with Arkham Origins was I just had so much fun with this game. And I think if you look at the positives are so myriad. We have, on the story side, we have one of the best Batmans ever in Roger Craig Smith.
Yeah.
Great performance. One of the best Jokers ever in Troy Baker. And it's so interesting to hear how he uses the same, basically, intonation as Mark Hamill.
Yeah, the same style of Joker voice.
But then goes in a different direction and is so dark and terrifying. You have a great story between Batman and Alfred, a great story between Batman and the Joker, I think. There's a Joker scene midway through the game that is one of my favorite scenes in any Batman story, let alone in the Arkham games. I think it's really intensely paced. I think it's really interesting from a sort of mystery angle. I think it handles the detective stuff even better than Rocksteady ever did. Some of the detective things you do, especially in the side quests, are a ton of fun and really fascinating and interesting. I think it builds to a great climax. I think it's got mostly really good boss fights that make you feel scale in a way that most modern boss fights don't. Most modern boss fights make you just feel anger.
Yeah.
This made me feel scale. And that's not to say they're all uniformly great. Mm-hmm. There are ones that are even sort of a mixed bag, like the Firefly one.
Yeah.
But even the Firefly one, scale-wise, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think that whole side of it is great. From a gameplay side, it's still that Rock City foundation, and they haven't done a damn thing to ruin it. It's still a great fighting system. It's really fun. It's more challenging than ever. I think the environments are really cool. They're maybe a little less detailed than what Rocksteady would have done, but I also think they reimagined Gotham City in some interesting ways.
Yeah.
And honestly, I should say this is a game that grew on me. When I started it the first couple hours, I was a little underwhelmed. And I think then when it picks up steam and it kind of, to me, shows its hand, in its gameplay styles and in its story, it gets more interesting to me. And honestly, I had so much fun with it, I couldn't put it down when I was done. And I kept doing collectibles, and I never wound up 100%ing it. But I just kept on playing this game until the PS4 came out, because it was just, I really was having a ton of fun with it. And so I think for me, you know, I've said before, my favorite Batman stories probably ever, or Batman experiences, I should say, yeah, are what Rocksteady has done with the Arkham games, and I think this lives up to that legacy in the ways that count most to me. It's still, this is a version of Batman and a style of Batman storytelling through interactive gameplay that I think is so wildly successful. And I really loved Arkham Origins for that.
Yeah. It's like the game definitely has a number of flaws. And then we talked about this game on a previous podcast. If you want us to,
hear us
talk about it more. But I just like one of the things that the game is still really, really good. It's built on a really powerful foundation. And then it's just such a shame that people never really gave it like anything, you know, like they just, as soon as the game was announced, everyone immediately dismissed it, and I did too initially, because it just seemed dumb. It seemed kind of lazy. In like, how many times have we fucking seen a Batman origin? Like, you know, in the comic books, they're doing the fucking, I think they're done now with the Year Zero, but they revisited very recently the Batman origin in the comics for New 52. And so it's like, how many times do we have to go back to the fucking origin story? Oh, it's not Rocksteady making it. But then when you actually just sit down and play the game and look at the game for what it is without all that other stuff outside of it affecting your opinion, you see it's a really fucking good game. And so, you know, if you're a big fan of the other Arkham games, I highly, highly recommend picking it up.
This is one of those games this year I paid a full $60 for and didn't regret it for a second. Loved paying whatever amount I had to pay for it, it was worth it. This was a good game.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I loved paying $60.
No.
But it was worth paying $60.
I never loved paying $60, but yeah.
I loved paying money for this game. If I had not paid money for this game, I would have been angry at myself.
Yeah, that's not what I meant. But I loved this game, and definitely, you know, it was the last full game I played before the new consoles, and it was a fun palate cleanser in that way.
Yeah.
All right, so Sean, you're number 8.
Yes, my number 8, continuing my theme of having Ubisoft games, is Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, if you had told me before this game came out that not only would this be one of my top 10 games of this year, but that I would think that Assassin's Creed 4 is the best Assassin's Creed game ever made, I would fucking slap you in the face and walked away laughing, because holy shit is this fucking franchise. Like, how fucked up is it that this is the 6th Assassin's Creed game and the last 2 have been pretty mediocre in a lot of ways? Like, I like 3 a lot more than most people, but 3 has a huge number of problems. And it's like, this is the one where it gets really good. Like, how is this the one that is the only one to live up to Assassin's Creed 2 to me, and is superior to Assassin's Creed 2 in a number of ways? Like, that fucking baffles me. Utterly and completely baffles me that this game is not just good, but it's fucking great.
I love it. Hey, Assassin's Creed 4 is on my list as well. Well, here we'll go. My number 8 was Resogun. We already talked about it.
Yeah.
My number 7 is Assassin's Creed 4.
Okay.
So one spot higher than you. And Grand Theft Auto V did not make my top 10. We're going to talk about it in a little bit.
Yeah.
But honestly, Assassin's Creed 4 came out of the blue for me because I've never played an Assassin's Creed before.
Yeah.
This was my start. And if you've never played one, this is a great starting point. I can attest to that.
Yeah.
Just don't go backwards.
Definitely don't go backwards.
And I really felt like what I wanted and didn't feel I personally got out of Grand Theft Auto V, I wound up finding in Black Flag. Because I'm still playing this game heavily, and I just lost myself in it. And there is so much to do. This game, if ever a game were worth $60, Assassin's Creed 4 has so much that when you're at like the 50% marker, you're still doing tutorial missions in a certain way. And you don't think of that as a bad thing, because there's just so many things to do. And yeah, some of them fall flat. When you have to do the things where you go to the bottom of the sea floor, the diving bell,
that's a little annoying. Yeah.
Not the best part.
Yeah, the controls are not...
not great.
Yeah.
But you know what? It doesn't matter, because
I played fucking better underwater missions in fucking Mario 64,
I actually recently replayed 64 I played it on the Wii, but like the 64 version. Yeah. Surprisingly good swimming controls.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people have bested that.
Yeah.
But anyway, Assassin's Creed 4 has so much content and so many different kinds of things to do, and they're all so well done, mostly so well done, that it just feels like you can really lose yourself in this world. And, you know, having a pirate setting is part of what's great. Mm-hmm. But what I think, to me, makes the game click is the same reason Persona clicks for me in a weird way. Mm-hmm. Which is that Persona, the Persona games, Persona 3 and 4, take basically this JRPG side and this game and this social simulator side. And as single games, neither of those maybe would be great games. Mm-hmm. But you put them together, and it paces and balances the game in such a great way, where either time you get tired of one side, you go to the other side.
Yeah.
And that's what Assassin's Creed 4 does for me, because it's got this pirate ship sim side, where you're on your ship, you're sailing around, you're fighting other ships, those pirate ship battles are so fuck yeah, awesome, amazing. But if you get tired of that, you can go on land, and mm-hmm. do the exploration, and do the hand-to-hand combat. And they feel like very separate games to me in a lot of ways, because I play them very differently.
Yeah.
You know, on the high seas, I'm kind of really involved. On land, I'm more like I'm listening to a podcast and running around killing dudes.
Yeah.
But I feel like having those two sides is great, because I know I would get tired of one if it was just one game.
Mm-hmm.
But put them together, and that it's so well-paced, and I love going back and forth. And honestly, no game has made me this obsessed with collectibles before, either. Because I love 100%ing everything in this game.
Yeah.
And it's addictive, and it's wonderful. And I even like the story, and I know a lot of people have been mediocre on that. I think it's not a great story, but it's exactly what... It's exactly propulsive enough and interesting enough to pull me along through the missions, but not in a way that distracts me from doing side stuff if I want to. And I like Edward Kenway as a character.
Yeah, no, like, I think the story is good. Like, it's not, like, amazing before, like, the game it is. Like, when the game ended, I was like, oh, that was actually... That was a enjoyable story that actually had, like, some interesting things to say about, like, the setting and the time period and, like, who pirates were and what they were and what they were doing and what they represent. It's like, huh. Like, you know, the modern-day storyline, like, in terms of, like, they do very little with the plot, but what they do is still fucking... It's just dumb. I mean, they have nothing to work with. Based on the ending of 3, there's nowhere to go but deeper down the rabbit hole that just is fucking dumb. But, yeah, like...
At least it's a little self-aware.
Yeah, no, it's beyond a little self-aware. You work at a fucking French-Canadian video game company that made Assassin's Creed 3 Liberation. Like, contextually in that world. Which also makes no fucking sense, because that company did not make Assassin's Creed 1, 2, Brotherhood, Revelations, or 3 in the context of that world. The only game they made was Assassin's Creed 3 Liberation. So how the fuck they title it that, I have no idea. But yeah, this is the single... But that's, like, one of the best things about the game, is the fact that Assassin's Creed 3 as a, like, franchise went down the fucking shitter. Like, it's just... bizarre, and they did so much shitty stuff with that franchise, and this is the first game they've made that realizes that fact and just fucking makes fun of it. Honestly, like, there's in the modern day stuff, if you read a bunch of, like, the little logs and stuff you pick up, like, they just, like, make fun of the fact that, like, the Ubisoft obviously is pushing it, like, or that company is pushing out its products every single year, Obsidian Entertainment. It's like, and that obviously is, like, hurting the quality of the products. Like, they joke about that within the game. They make fun of it. And I think that's... It's hilarious. It's hilarious in a lot of ways in sort of the modern-day stuff. But then, you know, obviously the core of the game is the, you know, the pirating shit, the actual gameplay. And that, like, what you said with the two different aspects of the gameplay, I think that's really right. That one of the best things about the game is it has this huge... huge variety of stuff that you can do, like, way more than any other open world game I've ever seen. That, like, because it's not only that it just has a lot of stuff to do, but so many different things that it's just like, you know, yeah, the diving missions maybe aren't great, but there's like 6 of them and that's it. And so it's like, if you just want to do a diving mission, it's like you can just do that, and then you can move on and you can go take out a fortress, or you can go hunt down some ships to get some supplies, or
go harpooning.
Yeah, you can go harpooning, you can just go hunting, you can go, like, do your assassination missions, you can go looking for collectibles, you can, you know, you can go take down a fort. Like, there's just so many fucking things you can do at any given time in this game. Or, you know, if you want, you could go play a fucking story mission.
Right.
And actually just play the game. Yeah, like, there's just... And the map is huge. Like, there's so much stuff, but it never feels overwhelming because so much of it is different. It's because you never feel like, oh, I have to do 70 assassination missions. It's like, no, there's like 20 in the game. That's totally... That's like every single side mission, there's like the perfect amount, you know?
Yep.
If you had to destroy 20 different forts, that would be maddening, but there's like 8. So it's like, that's... Yeah, by the time you've destroyed the 8th fort, you're like, I'm basically done. Like, I've gotten out of this side task what I want out of it, and if there were more of them, I'd be really annoyed because I wouldn't want to do them anymore, but I'd feel obligated to.
I even enjoy the game you have to play in your captain's quarters with your crew, with your...
Okay, I'm not entirely with you on that. I find that really boring. Okay. Like, I think that would be a lot more fun. Like, I know it is, like, a companion app thing, but it didn't do anything, like, didn't work for me, so...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
With your fleet, yeah. I haven't explored the companion app side, but I only play it for a couple minutes at a time, but I don't know. It's just... It's like a management thing that I just feel like it's just part of the landscape to me, and I like the whole so much, all the pieces work for me. Yeah, no, it's so much fun. It looks absolutely gorgeous, especially on next gen. The water effects, on the boat. I've never seen water like that in a game.
Yeah,
and just it's so great. And I think just the little touches, like, you know, we've mentioned this before, but your fucking crew singing shanties as you just sail the open seas.
It's great,
nothing like it.
Yeah, that's single greatest collectible in any video game ever. Are those sea shanties? I mean, actually getting them is kind of annoying. I don't like the fact that they run away, but once you get it, you're like, yes, because this one might be your favorite sea shanty so far. You don't know.
Absolutely.
Just wait till they start singing it.
And I think that's the most amazing thing to me is that, and maybe some of this just comes from that this is my first Assassin's Creed, but so much of what I love I know wasn't in the other games. This is the sixth game in a big franchise.
Yeah.
And I think it offers things that I have never seen in a video game before.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, just the ship aspect of it alone has never really been tackled. I mean, there are a couple of pirate games that have been made and a couple of naval combat games, but they're really niche. They tend to be very simulation-y and not very fun.
Yeah.
This is like the first like mainstream example of this I'm even aware of at all, like ever. And so that's fucking awesome. Like,
so thank God they delayed Watch Dogs because I had time to play.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it was a calculated tactical business decision, but fucking
I'm fine with it now because I got to play a pirate game and it was awesome. So, all right, that was my number seven. Sean, you want to tell us about your number seven?
Yes. My number seven is Papers, Please. And, you know, this is the song we played at the beginning is from Papers, Please. And I haven't actually told you this, but this gets the, like, I almost did not count this as being a game that I could put on this list because I didn't want to put games I didn't finish because I did not technically beat Papers, Please. I never got one of the endings. Because it's actually a flaw that I find with the game is I don't think it sustains itself for its whole run. But what it does do well, it does so well and is so unique that I had to put it on this list. So it's like I made a special exception that I tend not to ever put any, like, you know, because like putting a game you didn't technically beat on the list feels kind of like a movie you didn't see the last scene. But what was remarkable about Papers, Please, I don't think you need to beat to see. Because what was, like, Papers, Please, the basic concept of it is you play as this border official for this fictional country.
Astortska!
Yeah, in the 80s, sort of like, you know, with the Eastern Bloc and all that stuff. So you're working with this totalitarian communist company, or I keep on saying company, country. Because their companies today is basically would be the metaphor.
Right.
But, yeah, and so you're a border official, so people come to you to try to get into the country, and then you say, Papers, Please, or at least a text bubble pops up with some, like, sim...
Papers!
Yeah, Papers, Please. And then you have to they hand you their papers, you have to analyze them and see if, like, there are any indiscrepancies and whether or not they can come into the country, and then you either allow them in or you don't. And if you make a mistake, then you lose money, and you have a pretty tight budget because you also have your family members that you have to take care of at the end of each day. So you have to pay for, like, medicine if they're sick and the heating and that kind of stuff. And you tend to, like, very barely scrape by. Like, if you're doing really well, you make a little tiny bit of a profit at the end of the day, but not a whole lot. And then as each day goes, more and more layers get added on top of it where it's like they have other stuff that they need to hand you, or people will tell you that it's like, oh, there are terrorists, so now you need to scan people for weapons, and then when you do that, like, you actually get naked photographs of them, and that's like, and it's not, they're not sexy and naked photo. You don't want to be looking there, because that's one of the things I like about the game, that it'd be very easy to make that like a kind of a sexy thing. It's not, because they're just normal people. And they're not, they're not just normal people. They're normal people who are starving, running from, like, this horrible situation from these other countries. So they are not the kind of people that you want to look at naked, you know?
Right.
And, yeah, and so, you know, it obviously makes a lot of commentary about like, you know, the TSA and that kind of stuff. But beyond that, what the game really does for me, and it's something I have never seen anything else do, and it's something I think only a video game can do, is that it makes you understand the harsh reality of bureaucracy in a way nothing else can. Yeah. Because it puts you in those shoes of, like, making this decision of, like, do I let these people in or not? Because there are people who will come up to you with, like, a guy will come up and he'll have his papers and it'll be, everything will be in order, and he'll be like, the next person in line is my wife, or whatever. He'll just mention that in passing, and so he moves off. His wife comes up, then his wife, like, doesn't have, like, whatever special thing she needs to get in, and so now you're faced with the decision of, like, do I just split this family apart? And you're like, well, yeah, of course I do, because why the fuck, why did this lady come up to me with the wrong shit? Like, this is not my responsibility. Yeah. You didn't have your shit in order. What are you doing? What were you, like, what was your plan to get into the fucking country? That I would be an idiot? Or are you just relying on my good-hearted nature to just let these two people I don't know in? Like, you have no fucking idea what my situation is. Lady, get the fuck out of here. Go. If you say anything, I'm going to have the guard come over and detain you, because he's going to pass me a little something extra if I let him beat you up in the back alley.
And even more than that, here's the thing. My breaking... If I didn't break up your family, my family could get broken up. And why are you above me?
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, it's... Because it's something that, like, it's so easy when... Because you're so often on the other side of that equation of, like, you're dealing with this... Like, this person who is representing this faceless bureaucratic machine. And that is so frustrating, being on the other side of that equation. It's just like... Why can you not deal with this? Like, do you have no heart? Are you a fucking monster? But then you playing this game, you realize it's like, it's not like you interacting with that person is not significant. Like in within a bureaucracy, no, there is no individuality. No person exists. That it is, you are just literally a cog in the machine, and nobody has any power in this situation whatsoever. And so, like, you know, it sort of deconstructing the situation of, like, what you would normally consider, like, evil in so many ways, especially with the setting of what you, like, us as Americans especially would, like, really consider evil, which is, like, this idea of dystopian totalitarian society set in the, like, Eastern Bloc during the communist society. You look at that as evil, and, like, what this guy you're playing is doing, you feel like this is wrong, but it's like, how can it be wrong? Like, everything is fucking wrong. Like, this is just my goddamn job. It's not my responsibility. But is it your responsibility? My opinion is no, because it's not. It's like, you know, you're like, nobody has any power in the situation, and then leveraging it on any one person is stupid. But there's so many different moral conclusions you can come from in that situation that playing this game brings up, that it's like, it's, this game is so utterly fascinating. And it does have, you know, like the story element to it. I know there are a bunch of different endings, but like I said, like, I never felt really compelled to see the game all the way through, because I felt like after maybe like probably the first 15 days, I had acquired absolutely what I needed from it. And I suppose I would maybe call that a flaw for the game for me, but like I said, like, what it does is so remarkable, I don't even care that it has like that element of, like, I feel it's maybe a little bit too long.
All right. So that was your number 7.
Yeah.
My number 6 is also Papers, Please.
Yeah.
And
it's weird how our lists link up in a very convenient way.
Yes. And here's the thing. Everything you just said, perfect description of, I think, that thematic side to the game. And I've heard a lot of people talking about that, and that's why I played the game primarily. But I had such a vastly different experience than you. Because I got all that you're saying. And that was important to me, and it impressed me. But honestly, Papers, Please is my number 6 game of the year, because I just had fucking fun with it.
This heartless, disgusting fucking monster who's like, just fucking, yeah, if you want to, like, just throw more layers of complexity on here, if you want me to fucking stab people when they come up, if they're not allowed in, like, I'll fucking do it if it makes it more fun.
Sure. Well, here's the thing. All of that, I recognize...
This is Red Dead Redemption Jonathan coming out here, is what I'm seeing.
I recognized through the whole game that what I was doing was just interminably boring, because it's, you know, checking papers and stuff, but there was just some quality to it that was addictive, and eventually I realized I was just having fun with it, and I have 10 hours logged in this game on Steam.
Jesus.
10 fucking hours in Steam logged on this game. I have gotten, like, most of the endings, or at least a lot of the endings are just variations on other ones, so I've gotten most of the basic ones. I got an ending midway through where my son died and I betrayed the state and stuff. Yeah. But then I went to, like, the end of the game, And I got one ending I liked where I escaped Astortska. So then I went back to day 11 and replayed the whole thing to get the ending where I help Ezik and throw down the government. And eventually I'm going to go back to day 11 and play the game and help the government and throw down Ezik. But, like, that took me 10 hours to do all that, and I had a blast, and I had to consciously resist playing more so I could go play other games for the end of the year. But no, I had the total opposite where you could not make it through all of Papers, Please. I played fucking 10 hours of this game.
You can't get enough
of
it.
Detaining people, I love it. I love, you know, I got to this point where I was craving people having the wrong information so I could fuck them
up. You should really, like, move to North Korea or something, dude. Like, I think you'd work really well there. Yeah, like, and I should say, like, I did find, like, you know, that aspect of it of, like, trying to check the papers and stuff, that is mechanically very satisfying.
Yeah.
But, like, I just kind of got bored of it. But I, like, I understand how, like, if it kept on clicking for you, you'd keep on playing.
I think it's...
just not an inhuman monster like you are.
I just think it's a great mechanical foundation. I think it's really, it makes really, you know, it's done by one guy, Lucas Pope, and I think it's a really creative use of, you know, the materials he had to make this little game. And I think the story elements are really well done. I think they're very fun. I think it's fun to see all the different things that come through. It's very unpredictable in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And everything Sean said, I think it's a really creative indie game. And it kind of defines for me in this year just how creative people got with indie games and what you can do with so little. And the stories you can tell and the things you can say.
Yeah.
So really interesting to me. If you can get it on, I got it, you know, on the Steam sale for $5, but it's normally just $10 and worth it.
Yeah, totally worth that price, yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, that was my number six. Sean, what's your number six?
My number six is Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, which also wins the award for dumbest title, that, like, most unnecessary subtitle in the history of mankind.
Sisters, A Tale of Two Daughters.
Exactly.
Like, Humans, A Tale of Two Mammals.
It's just so redundant in that way. But, yeah, Brothers is a game, I played it on the 360, but since it's come out basically on everything, and when I was talking about, like, games that you can play in one sitting, like, this is one of those of, like, it is like, 2.5 hours long, and I talked about it a little bit on one podcast, where it was when I totally by coincidence, I wasn't thinking about it at all, I ended up playing this game through all the way on my actual older brother's birthday. It was just, like, a really weird coincidence. But, yeah, like, so... The basic premise of Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons is that you're playing as two brothers who also happen to be two sons of both a mother and a father, though the mother has died. You find that at the very beginning of the game.
That's sad.
The mother drowns, and then the younger brother witnesses it.
Oh, that's really sad.
Yeah. And then the father dies, or no, the father doesn't die. The father's sick at the very beginning. You have to go get him medicine, and so that's like the journey you have to go on, both the literal journey and the emotional journey you have to go on is finding this, like, magic tree or fucking something that has medicine for your father, and you play as both this older brother and younger brother at the same time, and the controls are basically, I think it's the older brother is on the left stick, and then he has like this like interact with the environment, which is on the left trigger, and then the younger brother is on the right stick, and his interaction is on the right trigger, and so you always control both of them at the same time, and like everything is about you manipulating both of these brothers at the same time. And
so it's like Ice Climbers.
Yes, only. Well, I mean, but you don't actually in Ice Climbers. Those two characters are originally that's the co-op character, and then in Smash Brothers, you don't control both of them at the same time. The one character just follows the other. It's not about Ice Climbers at all. Like, there's no relationship towards Ice Climbers. There is ice in this, but you don't really climb on it all that much.
Okay.
But yeah, but with Brothers, so like that's basically the setup, and then there's no dialogue or anything. Everything is like. Conveyed it like incredibly visually, and then it has really, really great music, and it's just this really powerful emotional journey that uses that control of both of the brothers at the same time so well. And especially, you know, like there's a moment at the end of the game where if you play the game you fucking know what the moment is, where it uses those controls to deliver this sort of very emotional moment in a way I've never seen any other game ever do, in this like purely mechanical way that it's like, it's really, really incredible, and it's the thing that gets this game on the list, because while I do really, really like the rest of the game, like, the art style is strong, and it has this really interesting sort of Celtic mythological influence in a lot of the art style, and there's one set piece in particular where you're going through this, like, battlefield of this of these giants that have obviously had like this massive battle here, but it's over, and like there's all these like carcasses of these giants. Like that section in particular is really, really impressive and really fucking cool. But the rest of the game is like, you know, there's not a lot sort of going on in terms of the mechanics. Like there's it's basically puzzles, but the puzzles are really simplistic. And so that part isn't necessarily hugely impressive. But the way everything in the game focuses on the ending and like to deliver that sort of emotional punch and that message, that like core thematic message it has at the very end is so powerful and so unique that that's absolutely what it had to be on this list. So
I'm really excited to play this game. It's on PS Plus in January, and I can't wait to play it.
Yeah, it's really, really fucking good.
Okay, so Sean, somewhere we got reversed in here.
Yeah, I don't remember what. I don't know like what we're what because we've skipped.
I know.
Numbers and then used numbers when we weren't supposed to.
It's okay. We're,
we fucked everything up.
Technically, you should be doing your number five now, but I'll just go with my number five because when we get to our four through one, we're identical on those. So,
which is a total coincidence. Yeah, we didn't make these lists together.
No. So, but anyway, my number five is just kind of a cheat, and I recognize that. My number five is Hotline Miami.
Yeah, because that game didn't come out this year, so...
Let me explain why.
This is a complete cheat.
It came out on PC in 2012.
Fuck you.
In 2013, it came out on OS X, Linux, PlayStation 3, and PlayStation Vita.
That doesn't...
And I played the PS3 and Vita versions, which control totally differently than the PC version. Yeah. So, it's like a movie that comes out in limited release at the end of one year, wide release at the beginning of the next year.
No,
and
you can not. No.
It's like that.
It doesn't. So, Jonathan doesn't have a number five. But Jonathan wants to talk about Hotline Miami, so... What do you have to say about Hotline Miami? I hear it's one of the best games of last year.
It was one of the best games of this year, too, I think. Because it came out to a much
wider... That doesn't fucking count! That doesn't, because it's not like if it had been Persona 4 the Golden, like, you can kind of justify that, but, like,
put Persona 4 the Golden on your list in a year, it didn't even... No, it did come out that
year.
No,
but I didn't even put Persona 4 the Golden. I put Persona 4 as my number zero game of the year. That was my 2012-2008 game of the year. That totally fucking counts. It was a special award. It wasn't my number one game of the year.
This isn't my number one game of the year.
Yeah, well, it's your number five, and it didn't fucking come out this year.
It kinda came out this year.
It doesn't fucking count. That would be like...
I've seen people cheating way more, like professional game critics on their
top 10. Yeah, well, fuck them. They're doing it just because they do it wrong doesn't mean you can do it wrong, too. You know, when, like it would be like if they re-released Doom on, like, the PS4 this year, and I played it, and it was like, this is the best game of this year because... Doom came out on this platform on this year. That doesn't count.
How does it not count?
Ports don't count. That would be like fucking me saying that the Tomb Raider Definitive Edition was going to be the best game of 2014 because they put in fucking Tress effects. That would be even more justified because it's actually an updated version. It's not just a literal port of the game.
It's kind of updated.
No,
there's new levels.
Is there?
Yeah, at the end.
Do the new levels, is that what makes it the best game of this year?
They're really good, but no.
Yeah.
What makes Hotline Miami, and I didn't say it was the best game of the year.
Okay, number five game of the year.
Number five, because...
You don't have a number five game of the year, that slot is blank, but Hotline Miami is a fantastic game, so talk about Hotline Miami. Let's compromise.
Because Hotline Miami came out on the platforms I actually own this year...
Here, Hotline Miami is your number zero game of the year. It is your 2013-2012 game of the year.
Okay. Number five, Hotline Miami, talked about this back in the summer when it came out on PlayStation. I think Hotline Miami is just such a tremendous use of sort of this minimalist violence form. It goes back to, you know, this very kind of 16-bit graphics, but it is absolutely absurdly violent and brutal, and it's very reflexively violent and brutal. So it's incredibly fun. It's got a really tight gameplay foundation. I feel the same way about it as I feel about Resogun, where it takes a little while to get used to.
Yeah.
Once you get used to it, it really clicks. It's really fun. It's incredibly difficult. And it's very brutal. And it makes you earn your victories. But at the same time, it makes you feel absolutely disgusted and sick with what you're doing. And that dichotomy is really interesting. And we're going to talk about another game later on this list that dissects video game form, and I think does it much more coherently than Hotline Miami. But Hotline Miami, the way it dissects video game violence and video game form, and the urge to kind of keep playing even when you're kind of disgusted by what you're doing, I think that's really interesting. And I think the kind of really ambiguous, silly note it ends on is kind of perfect. I think the overall style of the game, especially its music, but also the graphics and the use of color and the kind of very sleazy atmosphere to it, it's all so all-encompassing. Like Papers, Please, I played the hell out of this game. I still boot it up on my Vita all the time and, mm-hmm. and play it. In terms of, you know, the console ports that came out this year, I'm really talking about the Vita version because I think the PS3 version is a lesser experience. It does not control particularly well.
Yeah.
On the Vita, because they have the touchscreen,
yeah.
it works really well. And I also think it looks better. I think when you blow Hotline Miami up to a 40-inch TV, I don't think it really holds up. But I think on the Vita screen, man, it looks great. And it's just, it's kind of the perfect Vita game. And I think because the Vita became in 2013 to me this indie game system, Hotline Miami was a really defining release for the Vita this year. And Sony treated it as one, too. It was a PlayStation Plus release later in the year, but even when it came out and at all their press conferences at E3 and stuff, Hotline Miami was kind of held up as kind of this icon of their kind of indie game strategy for the Vita, and it definitely defined that for me this
year. Even though technically it's not an indie game because it was published by Devolver Digital, so.
Okay, well, it was made by like 5 people.
Yeah, but in like indie game technically means it was self-published.
Okay, well,
that's just all I'm saying. Okay. It's not literally an indie game.
It's kind of like, you've talked about Journey to have that indie game spirit, even though it's not technically an indie game. It's that same thing for me with Hotline Miami. But yeah, you're right. So, just, yeah, it
also didn't come out this year.
Okay, it came out on the Vita this year, and this was part of the argument I was making for being on my list for 2013. It was kind of defining for me in that way as a Vita owner, because I think it was kind of a landmark release for the Vita and summed up a lot of how the Vita shifted directions this year in a way that I found pretty cool. Like, and I think Sony did some stuff this year with the Vita. This is kind of off topic, but there's this game I kind of played a little bit of, and that's interesting, is the Tearaway game that came out at the end of the year, was Sony kind of trying to reorient towards maybe how AAA titles could work on the Vita. And that game completely rubbed me the wrong way. It is dumb gimmick, the game. And
did it give you a paper cut?
No. Ha ha ha. But yeah, I mean, that
whole game, that whole game is all paper crap.
Yeah. Yeah, that whole game is about what Vita gimmicks can we use in a weird way in the style. Yeah,
you haven't played Uncharted Golden Abyss. Don't you talk to
Tearaway is like Uncharted Golden Abyss as a full game. Like that first tutorial mission. But yeah. No, so yeah, but I really like that indie game direction for the Vita. That's mostly what I use it now for, and Hotline Miami is one that springs to mind for me on that. So that is my 2013-2012 number 5 game of the year.
Okay.
All right. What's your number 5 game, Sean?
My number 5 game is Sonic the Hedgehog 2, because
shut the
while
fuck.
Sonic
this
the
is
Hedgehog
so
2
unfair.
Came out in 1992,
fuck you.
It got re-released on iOS this year with the Hidden Palace Zone recreated and put in now. So Sonic the Hedgehog 2. And then my next game of the year is Oddworld Strangers Wrath HD, which got re-released on the Vita this year. And it's, you know, it's basically the same game, but they up-res the graphics, so I think it looks really good now. So I think that's the best game. Okay.
You're a dick.
I was, like, while you were talking, I was desperately trying to, like, think of any ports of games I played this year. I'm sure there's some version of Tetris that came out this year on something. That's the best game. And then also there's probably some version of, like, Super Mario or something. I don't know.
Did you honestly play Sonic the Hedgehog 2 on iOS?
I haven't actually played it, but...
Okay. Because Sonic on iOS, I have, like, my brother bought the first one. Yeah. You cannot play that game on an iPhone. It does not work in the slightest.
I can play Sonic the Hedgehog on anything.
Okay.
I played Sonic the Hedgehog on, like, a psychic interface or something. It doesn't matter. I played that game so fucking much.
All right. But so what's your number 5 game of the year?
Okay, my actual number 5 game of the year is Grand Theft Auto 5.
Picked simply for the gimmick of 5-5,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's how I usually construct my list, yes.
Okay.
But no, like, and I don't even know how much we need to talk about Grand Theft Auto 5, because we talked about it at length across... We made a trilogy of podcasts where there was discussion about Grand Theft Auto 5, a significant discussion about it in all three. So.
And I think the third one, where the whole episode was devoted to it, I think is one of our best discussions.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a really good one, but yeah.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, it's Grand Theft Auto 5, like, obviously it has its problems. Like, we both, like, you take much more exception at it than I do, but I think, like, even though its story is ultimately disappointing, there's still a lot of really good stuff in the story. I think the sort of the world and the tone they make is as always really well done, even if a lot of, like, the like, environmental satirical elements I find have, like, as they have always been, are way overdone and not particularly funny, but it's like, it kind of adds an element of charm to it at the same time that it's not funny. Like, it's like, it's Grand Theft Auto. Like, it's always been this, like, the billboards are fucking stupid kind of thing. But like, I just think the world they created with Los Santos, it's so much fun for me to just, because I just the other day I loaded it up again for the first time in a while and just sort of, like, drove around and played around in that world. And it's just so much fun to just be in that world and just to fuck around and just, you know, just randomly stab people on the street or to just go up to the top of Mount Chiliad, the highest mountain in the game, then get on a dirt bike and drive off the edge and see how long you can survive bouncing down the mountain. And so, even with its flaws, I think Grand Theft Auto V is so much fun to play, and the world they made is so much fun to inhabit, and it's just below Red Dead Redemption in terms of, like, just me wanting to be in the world and kind of fuck around and do stuff, but it just being below Red Dead Redemption is still remarkable, because Red Dead Redemption is one of my favorite games ever of all time, so.
And Grand Theft Auto V is not on my top 10 list, and really never could be, because while there are things I think that are really remarkable about the game and fun times I had with it that I definitely cherish, like going to the top of Mount...
Yeah, like you fell in love with the game. That's what you said on the first podcast.
Well, and I think... But that's my problem, is that I think the
then
first...
Then you fell in love with it, and then it broke your heart.
Yeah, it definitely broke my heart, because I think it's... The first couple hours are really good, and then I think it goes... I think... I don't like the campaign at all. I don't. I don't think it's good. I don't
I think
like
the,
it as
a, I think in terms of mission design, it's the best campaign they've ever done.
Okay.
In terms of story.
And I didn't
not, but.
I didn't enjoy the missions. I didn't enjoy the story. I spent... And here's the main reason it just couldn't be on my top 10. I spent a good, 15 hours with the campaign, like the last 15, 20 hours of the campaign, not wanting to play the game and playing it solely so I could talk about it on the podcast. And that was unhealthy, and I maybe shouldn't have done it, because I wound up disliking the game way more than I would have if I just had cut my losses and goofed around in Los Santos. But that's basically it. And I also, I don't know, it doesn't have the same tail to me as other Rockstar games have, where, like, when I boot it back up and try to play it, I goof around for a couple minutes, but I also feel like I've done this all before, and I just don't, it just doesn't hold my interest. So I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, because it's a really good game, and I'm sorry you're wrong.
I'm not wrong.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that it is interesting that it's like you like to talk about it on the podcast. You forced yourself to finish this game, whereas Red Dead Redemption literally took you like 3 years to finish.
Yeah,
that you should have spaced this one out over at least a couple of years, at the very least.
Yeah, who knows? But I mean, I also came late to Red Dead Redemption in the first place. But yeah, and I honestly would have said for a while Grand Theft Auto V was my pick for most overrated game of the year, but I haven't seen it on any top 10 lists, so.
It's been on a couple, but yeah, they tend not. It's not really been picked as number one in a lot of places.
I haven't even seen it on top 10 lists, basically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, like I'm saying I've seen it on a few,
yeah.
But it's like I've only seen it as the top pick on one top 10 list.
So, anyway, but that was your number five. The rest of, and as I said, 4 through 1, by pure coincidence, are the same for both of us.
Yes.
So, should we just say them all together?
I mean,
number four
yeah,
is.
Yeah, but we should say number four and then talk about it, not say them all together, and then like we should say them all together, and that both of us say it at the same time, but not all together in the sense that we say all of them all together at the same time.
Right, good point.
Yes. So
number four is
our number four is
the Stanley Parable.
That was terrible. Okay, one more.
Number four
is the Stanley Parable.
Yay! Okay. Stanley Parable is fucking awesome.
Yeah, it is. So here, you start talking about it.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know
I'd have to do this. Stanley,
you have to start those things I told you to.
Okay, I have played it more recently. The Stanley Parable is just so wonderfully inventive. And I think you can talk for hours about how, all the things it has to say about video game design and the way it deconstructs it and all that.
Yeah.
But honestly, it's the same thing for me as with Papers, Please, is what makes the Stanley Parable so fun and why I keep coming back to it and why it's number four for me is I just love living in that game and being in it. Because, yes, it has really smart and insightful things to say and it does it in a really creative way, but there's just such a level of discovery to it where you can start the game and be like, huh, what happens if I just close the door? Oh, I get an ending right here in my office. What happens if I take the right door and then do this, this, and this?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that was really kind of dark and sad and kind of scary. Oh, man, what if I jump off the platform here? That was funny. Mm-hmm. What if I lock myself in this broom cupboard? That is my favorite gaming moment of 2013. It's great. There's just such a level of
fun. I like how you
keep
on getting 2013 and 2012 mixed up.
I have a mental disorder. No, Stanley Parable, and man, the voice work done by the narrator is so funny, and it's just, man, it's just great to go back into it and find new endings and things to do and relive things you've done in the past, and all of that wrapped in a package that does have a really good intelligent core to it.
Yeah. So, to sort of lay out the premise of the Stanley Parable, because it's so completely and utterly unique, is basically you play as Stanley, or at least I think you play as Stanley, and you're in an office, and then a narrator starts talking to you, and he basically says, everyone in your office has mysteriously disappeared. You should go to your boss's office and ask him about it.
And before that, we should say Stanley's job is that he gives button commands and he pushes them all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you're basically commanded to go to your boss's office and see what the fuck's going on. And then along the way, you enter a room where there is a door on the left and the door on the right. And then the narrator says, and then Stanley entered the door on the left. And then you are then completely... Or at least that's like the moment when you hit it of like you realize... What the game is, well, there are two doors. And the narrator's saying, I go to the door on the left. Fuck that guy. I want to go into the door on the right. And so then you go in the door on the right. And then you're encountered with all these different choices. And then, like, him, the narrator, is constantly kind of trying to guide you along a certain way. And you're constantly faced with this choice of, do I do what he's saying? Or do I try to defy what he's saying? And how many different ways can I defy what he's saying? And I saw this, I really like this, I saw this game on a top 10 list. I wish I could remember who wrote this, because it was a really smart way of describing this game. In that terms of, like, I was, like, having such a hard time sort of reconciling, what is this game? Like, what is the mechanic of this game? What, like, makes it, not just because it's, you know, it's really funny, the narration is really, really funny and clever, but there's something really fun about playing the game on top of just, like, getting the narration that, like, you know, just... hearing like the audio files would not have the same impact as like what you're how you're playing it. And then the guy described it as the game is a puzzle game, but it's not a puzzle game in the traditional sense, because the puzzle is how many different endings can you find. And I think that's a really clever way of putting it, is that that's exactly what it is. It is this puzzle that like you as you're playing the game, or at least I did, I like you create this like mental sort of like web, like this flow chart of like, okay, if you go here, there's like all these different branching paths.
Yep.
And then it's like you go here and then here and then here, and you're like, every time you're encountered with a decision, you make like a mental check of like, okay, next time I play this, I'm going this way. And then you just kind of like try to make your way down the flowchart to find absolutely everything you can. And so then one of the unique things about that is that like I played this game sort of like in two really big sessions and found a lot of endings that way. And then every once in a while, I'll just be like, I kind of just want to play the Stanley Parable, and I'll load it up and then I'll try to find another ending. And I still don't think I found everything, because I've avoided looking up what all the endings are to like, because I don't want to know. I want there to always be another ending in the Stanley Parable for me. But yeah, it's just, and yeah, like you said, it's really funny, and that like that is what like the best part of the game really is, like that narration and the creativity and cleverness of it. But then it also does have a lot of really interesting stuff to say about the nature of game design and about the nature of like what you as the player are and what you're doing. And I think it has a lot of stuff to say about this really interesting dichotomy that every single game faces, which is this balance between sort of the artistic choice and the story and what you're trying to push with the game, and then like allowing player choice and player liberty. And obviously, you know, no game can have complete player liberty, because that wouldn't be fun, because it'd have no structure. But no game can have complete and utter just pure structure, because then you would feel you're not participating in any way and you wouldn't want to play the game. And so the Stanley Parable, it's so fascinating how it sort of deconstructs that and says, like, you know, neither the, like, structured way is not best and the, like, you know, chaotic way is not best. It's, there's the balance in the middle that is so tricky to find, and then every single game has its own balance that it needs to find.
Right.
And I think that's just, you know, it's really funny, but it's also really smart and like, genuine, and it's sort of, like, intellectual discussion about video games.
And honestly, I think the biggest thematic moments can... they're very personal in a lot of ways, and I think they can come from places you don't expect.
Yeah.
Like, for me, the moment where it maybe hit me hardest what this game was about was I was playing it with my brother, and we did the broom closet ending, where you just sit in the broom closet and the narrator talks. And we were waiting. We listened to him for, like, 5 minutes, and then he wasn't talking anymore. And you wait and you wait because you want to hear more. And I just leaned to my brother, and I'm like, this is what this game is about.
Yeah.
We can sit in this broom cupboard all day if we want, but we're not playing anything. And eventually we're going to have to go out, because the game doesn't have anything for us here.
Yeah.
And that's... and I think I really do think, as funny... even the funniest moments have all that depth to it.
Yeah.
And I think there are moments that are also very complex in how you feel about them.
Yeah.
Like an ending where you make the narrator really sad. I won't spoil it. But there's one where the narrator becomes pretty depressed.
Yeah.
And it's conflicting while you're playing it. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just so much stuff in this game. It's so clever, and it's so hard to find everything. And there's just absolutely nothing like the Stanley Parable, no. like, anywhere. It's just it's utterly unique, and it's awesome.
And I think we've got a couple more to talk about yeah. like that, to me. Like, at least one more on this list. Yeah. It just feels so like that. But anyway. All right, so, Sean, you want to try the same thing with number three?
Okay, yeah.
Our number three is Bioshock Infinite.
Woo!
We should have confetti.
Yeah. All right. We do have confetti.
Jonathan. Oh, it's everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, man, this is such a pain in the ass because we're going to have to clean it up. But, you know, I think it's really appropriate for our end-of-year festivities, Jonathan.
It is. It is. So, number three, Bioshock Infinite. Sean, going to throw it to you to start off
okay.
on this one.
Yeah. So, you know, we did, well, kind of like with Grand Theft Auto V, we have a podcast that is utterly, completely about Bioshock Infinite, like just deconstructing everything that was right after we played it. So it's probably a lot better just go listen to that if you haven't already to hear what we think about Bioshock Infinite.
Right.
But I guess, you know, like, looking back on it now, I think what Bioshock Infinite won, it was the first game of this year that was... Because, you know, Nintendo called this the year of Luigi. Fuck them. This is the year of Troy Baker. Like, that's yes. what this year was.
Yes.
And this was the first one of this... You know, obviously we knew Troy Baker from Persona 4, but, like, his performances this year were so astounding, and this was the first one for this year. And, man, dude, he... And the woman who plays Elizabeth, they are both so fucking good in this game. Their performances and then the writing and that element of the story is so fucking good and so involving in a way that in particular is really impressive because first-person shooters typically don't have that. That is also a really remarkable thing about the first Bioshock. But the first Bioshock doesn't have the character relationship element the way that the Infinite does. And I think that's actually something that ultimately I prefer Bioshock Infinite over the original... Partially, I think, because of that. Because I think the relationship between Booker and Elizabeth is so interesting. And especially the way you feel about it because you're, you know, put into the role of Booker. You're looking through Booker's eyes. Makes that relationship really complex as you, the player. And that's an element of it that really stands out in terms of the storytelling. And then also, the ending is fucking mind-bending in, like, the most literal way possible. But
it's what Christopher Nolan wants.
Yeah, exactly. It's like if the ending of Inception wasn't dumb and entirely predictable.
Yeah, and it's... Bioshock Infinite, to me, I think it's one of the greatest games ever made. And you talk about the story side, and the story side is so fucking incredible. And I think the way it dissects the nature of evil and of sin and of guilt and the way it tackles religion yeah. and how religion operates in societies and who it preys on and what it offers and what it doesn't offer and how all of that, everything the game throws out, so many thematic threads all come together in that last half hour, which is one of the best half hours of gaming I've ever yeah. seen, of storytelling I've ever yeah. seen. It's a great finale. And it really, you finish that game and you just have to sit there processing it. And I'm so glad that the credits kind of allow you to yeah. do that because they bring in Troy Baker and the, I wish I remembered her name, yeah. the actress who plays Elizabeth singing Will the Circle Be Unbroken, and it's the perfect processing song.
Yeah.
But at the same time, 2013 was a year where I realized I don't care about first-person shooters anymore. Not a genre that interests me anymore. I feel like I've played it out. You know, I will go back to Halo every once in a while because yeah. I love Halo, but it's just not a genre that offers me much anymore. And yet, Bioshock Infinite has so much to offer me, and I want to go back and play it again soon. And I feel like it is such a good first-person shooter. And I think it's gotten a lot of really unnecessary flack for
like
its gameplay.
Yeah, I found like the harsh sort of turnaround on the public opinion on this game really sort of strange.
Me too, because I think it's got a great gameplay foundation.
Yeah,
I think the actual shooting weapons are really well done, but also the vigors in this game really cool and how they all come together. It's a really great gameplay foundation, but more than anything else, I think the level design in Bioshock Infinite is fantastic. And I've talked about this dichotomy a lot yeah. before. Like, I think technically the shooting in Mass Effect 3 is better than in 2, but I think yeah. the level design is so much worse, it's moot for me.
Yeah.
Whereas in Bioshock Infinite, I think the gameplay foundation is really good, but it's ultimately fairly simple. It's what you do with it in the level design that matters. And when you get to those big arenas and yeah. you have the skyhook and everything to go off of and you are let free to do what you want, it's fantastic. It's incredibly fun, but it also makes you think. I think every part of this game, it's not the same as a game we're going to talk about soon, The Last of Us, which kind of eliminates ludonarrative dissonance.
Yeah.
But Bioshock Infinite links you to your character so completely because you are constantly doing these horrible acts of violence And that's not... You are supposed to be thinking about that. Yeah. Absolutely. Because, again, violence, sin, and guilt are so key to this game.
Yeah.
And you have to feel those things. You really do. And I think Bioshock Infinite makes you feel that when you're playing this game. And so it manages to kind of have its cake and eat it, too, on that level of being a really fun first-person shooter, but also one that makes you think. And I think that it, the way it functions on all those levels elevates it above first-person shooters I just, you know, couldn't get into this year.
Yeah, and in particular, in terms of just the gameplay design, I think one thing about it that's really interesting and I really appreciate is that, you know, because most first-person shooters, you know, like a Call of Duty or a Halo, it tends to be very sort of straightforward with the gameplay of, like, you know, especially if it's a modern military shooter, it's like, you know, 90% of all the weapons are going to just be an assault rifle, and the assault rifle is going to be the best weapon in every situation other than, like, the time they give you the sniper rifle. Well, Bioshock Infinite's not designed that way. In Bioshock Infinite, the combination of the different weapons, which by using the vending machines you can have access to basically at any time you want, and then also the, all the vigors you have, it allows you to fully and utterly customize your playing style in a way that's really fascinating because... Like, every person I've seen, I've talked to, or seen talk about it online, like, they have their own unique way of that they approach the combat. Their own weapons they chose and their own vigors they chose and the way they use that combination is unique for most people. Like, obviously, there's a finite finite ways you can do that. But for most people, it's like, you know, for me, I've almost exclusively used the carbine and the shotgun, and I use the charge thing constantly because that was, like, the way I built my character. Like, all the gear you can get, which is randomized, like... influences that, and that's something that I really appreciate because I like that you being able to customize your gameplay and then sort of like specialize in one style and then really focus on it. It's similar to when I talked about Blacklist. It's like Blacklist lets you approach every situation in any different way, and any different way is viable. Like, you, if it's not like this way, this room, you have to have a sniper rifle, or there's absolutely no way you can solve this. It's like, no, like, you can walk into any room with a goddamn pistol. And there's a way to beat that room, and there's a way to do it in a really cool, badass way, and you just have to kind of figure it out and get really good at using that weapon or that combination of weapons. Bioshock Infinite definitely has that, and I think that element of the combat is immensely well-designed and balanced.
Absolutely. And again, you know, when I start thinking about this game and everything that goes into it, there's just so much scarred in my memory. I just love every inch of this game. Maybe the part with the ghost wife, that's...
Yeah, slow. That part's obviously, like, the weakest link in terms of design.
It's also pretty minor overall. But, yeah. Man, what it builds to in the end, and all the stuff between Comstock and Booker and Elizabeth, those are gaming memories I will never forget, yeah. And that will never be decreased in power. That is just some great interactive storytelling.
Yeah. And definitely, like, the end of the game. Like, what, like the very... Like, you know, this game has been out for like a year, but still don't want to spoil it. Like, the moment you understand what the ending of the game is, when that it makes that switch,
it hits hard.
And that's one of the most, like, that is a memory in terms of, like, video game storytelling that I will never forget. Like, that moment is made such an impact. Yeah.
And I think we also have to talk about the world of Columbia.
Yeah.
And yes. How a few video game worlds this year, maybe none, were this fully built, mm-hmm. And just so well realized. And I love so also...
fascinating.
Yeah. And also, here's something I think is so cool, is that they build Columbia, and, you know, what you were introduced to in the first couple hours, that is more than enough for a full video game. Yeah. And yet, they are never content to let that be the world. They are constantly changing it, constantly giving you new versions. It's always in flux. And that is so bold in many ways, mm-hmm. to say, we've got this great world, let's change it within this one game. Fascinating. So anything else to say on this one?
I mean, yeah, Bioshock Infinite's fucking good. It's really fucking... And I'm probably going to replay in the next couple of days.
Yeah.
I've been looking at it on my shelf and be like, I should play that again.
It's coming out on PS Plus even, which I don't know how much Sony had to pay to get that to happen, but yeah, it's coming out on PS Plus this month, so
cool.
I sold my physical copy. All right. So let's move on, Sean. I'm excited to talk about this one.
Yeah.
Number two, Gone Home. Everywhere.
Yeah, oh my God,
it's crazy. It's getting in the computer.
Yeah, this is going to be troublesome.
Yes, no. Number two is Gone Home, and I will say personally, Gone Home I played on December 31st. This was the last game I played of 2013, and I had such an immediate, like, I don't know. This game so immediately gripped and transfixed me. just faster than any game I've ever played. I was in this game, and I could not stop until I was done. And I had a really interesting experience that I don't want to say for fear of spoiling it. Maybe we can talk about that later. But in terms of like how I finished the game and how I went back and some things that happened. But honestly, gone home until yesterday, I spent a lot of time thinking about this, whether this was my number one or not. It was my number one until yesterday, and I thought about it a little more. My number two and one are so different, it's hard to compare them.
Yeah.
But ultimately, Gone Home was number two, but it feels just as strong as a number one to me. And, you know, if you don't know the premise, basically, it's you're this young woman named Katie. You've been out of the country on study abroad or something like that.
You were traveling across Europe.
Right. And you come home, and it's a rainy night. You get into your house.
It's a dark and stormy night.
It is a dark and stormy night.
Yeah.
You have not seen this house before. This is a mansion your family has moved into in the past year while you've been gone. You kind of look around, find the key, and then you go to the door, and this is the moment where, to me, the game just kind of sets its hooks in this really interesting role-playing way, where there's a note from your sister, something has happened to her, and there's no one in the house. And immediately, to me, it became... I got into the mindset of Katie. I was in this character. I needed to learn everything I could.
Yeah.
And I had this really deep role-playing experience, because what Gone Home really is it's the story of Sam, your sister.
Yeah.
And she's a troubled young woman, you know, teenage girl. And you have to kind of find out what those troubles were, what happened to her, and why the house is empty.
Mm-hmm.
And that journey is just one of the best journeys in any story I experienced in 2013.
Yeah. It's almost as good of a journey as Journey's Journey.
Indeed. But gameplay-wise, Gone Home, you have free run of the house. You don't have to do anything in any set order. It is completely, you know, free-roaming in that sense. You can go anywhere, learn things. It's similar to Myst, but here's the interesting thing. I could never get into the Myst games when they were coming out. And Gone Home made me realize why. Because Gone Home has what was good about Myst, which is this like full world you can explore that's really cool, and a lot of things you can pick up and interact with and read things and learn things at your own leisure. But Myst is cryptic and has a lot of stupid puzzles.
Yes, it does, yeah.
Whereas Gone Home, and this is what makes it click for me, Gone Home is not cryptic. It is not holding things back from you. Everything is there. You just need to find it, and you put it together yourself. It puts a lot of trust on you. But it's not being cryptic and annoying.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Like, all the little, like, sort of, like, vague, puzzly elements feel very natural. And that's sort of, like, one of the things about the Gone Home is that, you know, basically the entire game is that house and the way you explore the house. And the mechanic of the game is you sort of playing that makeshift detective of trying to figure out what's going on. But the only tool you have at your disposal is just looking at shit, basically. Yeah. You just look around, you pick up stuff. You know, you can find keys. Like, basically, the progression is gated by you finding keys to open different doors and stuff. Or finding, like, there are, like, some secret passageways and stuff that you discover later on.
Yeah.
And all that sort of, like, unfolds as you pick up, like, sort of key items that, like the most key items are related to Sam's story, which are associated with, like, these sort of mysterious audio logs of somehow she is I justified it as she is psychopathically communicating with you in your mind, and that's how you're getting, because you just pick up notes and then it's like somehow she is communicating with you in an audio form, because it's not literally leaving audio diaries, but they're just audio diaries. But,
well, you find out the source of them later.
But it's still, in the moment, it doesn't make any sense. But you pick up these effectively audio diaries and get the sort of like what the core story is
with tremendous voice acting.
Yeah, the voice acting is really great about Sam and what's happened with her and the sort of core mystery. But then also, obviously, there's your mother and father who are also, you know, not in the house for reasons that are first unexplained. And then you're sort of uncovering their stories along the way that don't have audio logs, because who gives a shit about mom and dad? They don't get voice actors. But they both have their own stories that are very interesting in their own right. And then there's also this, like, other mystery about, like, the previous owner of the house who was your, like, other, like, relative who has passed away.
It's an uncle.
Yeah. And then you're trying to... granduncle, I guess, technically.
Yeah, because he's the father's uncle.
So, and he's passed away, and he left your father the house, and you're sort of, like, figuring out what happened with him, too, and that's very sort of, like, in the background. But you're sort of, like, uncovering all these mysteries through these items placed in the house. But the key thing is that those items don't feel... they don't feel like they are put there by a guy making a video game. They
Not
feel
at all.
Like
yeah.
this was just what the house was. Like, you just walked into a house, and here's all this shit. And it would be like if you just, like, broke into someone's house and nobody was there. And you're like, what the fuck, who are these people, like, where are they right now, what's going on? You know, obviously some of it is, like, very convenient for the sake of telling a story, but it feels naturalistic enough that you buy it, and you don't even think about the fact that you have to buy it while you're playing it.
Absolutely, and you know, the best description I've seen of this was also on a top 10, and I don't remember who, was that, you know, Gone Home, you look at it at first and it feels like, is this a ghost story or something?
Yeah.
And it is a ghost story, but the ghosts are the scars that have been left on this house, and you deciphering those scars. The house is haunted, but it's haunted by these scars and of the past, and personally, I think it has a lot to say about how the places we live and we inhabit, we leave our own damage on.
Yeah, you leave a note card that has, like, Street Fighter 2 moves on it and shit.
Right, and that says something about you.
That
and
you like playing Street Fighter 2?
Right, and I think the way
you
live...
have a really bad memory.
And, you know, the way you live and what you leave behind, those scars are very real, and they can exist in the places we live and we inhabit. And it's just so fascinating to go around and find those things. And I just... I've never played anything like Gone Home, even though with the missed connection I made, just the way this house feels so completely inhabited and, like, lived in, I should say. It's obviously not inhabited at the moment, but so
or
lived in.
Or is it?
It's so lived in, and it feels so satisfying to go around and learn these things. You piece it together completely in your head. At times, you may have a completely wrong impressions until you get new information. Like, I beat the game technically in 55 minutes.
That's way faster than it took me. I think it took me exactly 2 hours to beat it.
And it was partially on accident, and I only had a partial story, but I was so into it and so invested in role-playing this character and in this story that
I kind of, idiot.
Well, I was kind of frantically trying to figure out what was going on, and once I had gotten the gist of it, the next 2 or 3 hours I played after beating it and coming back and just looking around, those were the best to me of having had that stress removed and then going around the house. It was really interesting to me. And I think anyone who plays this is going to have a totally different experience in terms of how they perceive it. And I think that perception element of it is so crucial.
Yeah, because it shares this in common with Bioshock Infinite, because actually the people who made Gone Home, Fulbright Company, is composed of people who worked on Bioshock 2 and Bioshock 1. And so because honestly, you could boil down Gone Home's gameplay structure as it being like that other half to the Bioshock games of you're walking around the environments and picking up audio logs, and like that, there's that aspect of it that, like, everybody's going to find different things, and on your first playthrough nobody's going to find everything, and so you get like most people are going to find most of, if not all of, the Sam things, because those are, like, obviously, like, placed right in your path, but like a lot of the aspects of the side stories you're not going to figure out right away, because you're not going to find everything, and other people will have found different aspects of the story and have different opinions on it and different perspectives on it, which I always love that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but just from a story element, you know, there's been a lot of talk this year about, you know, the problem gaming has with women, and we've said before it's not the problem gaming has with women.
It's the problem society has with women.
Yes.
Thank you.
It's in no way contained to gaming. I don't think it's in any way worse than gaming if you look at modern movies and TV and shit. It's, you know, it's problematic everywhere. But Gone Home is still so significant to me in being a female-centric story with, you know, exploring, having a female main character, exploring female sexuality in some ways. It is, I think it does things narratively and thematically that games just don't touch upon.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is part of what makes it so immensely special. Mm-hmm. I mean, thinking about it now even, it's like, this number 2-1 split for me is fucking tough ranking these. Because Gone Home really hit me hard. Yeah.
It was really interesting with my experience with Gone Home. Because I really liked it my first playthrough, but I didn't... Like Gone Home was actually the hardest one for me to figure out where to place it on the list, not because I thought it should be number one, but I didn't know if I wanted it that high. Like, this could have been number 10 for me, and, like, in particular, there's a thing about the game in terms of... There's a sort of, like, bait-and-switch element of it where, like, the way it presents it up front with, like, sort of, like, the mysterious note on the door, the dark and stormy night, like, those very sort of, like, cliche horror elements are very deliberate, that it does kind of want you at first to think that there's some sort of, like, ghost... thing, possibly horror thing going on. And in particular, the prime mystery, like the ultimate goal you're presented with once you get into the house, is the attic. Because the attic, you're trying to find, I think you're finding like the key to the attic or something, but you can't get into the attic at first. Everything leads to the attic. That's where the ending is. And you know there's something in the attic, and you know if you're like kind of going for like the bait and switch thing with the kind of vaguely horror stuff, there's an obvious thing that the game is hinting at that is going to be in the attic that is not in the attic at the end. And but what is there instead, like, I'm not going to spoil it, but like that sort of bait and switch, still right now, talking about it right now, I don't know if I think it's a bad decision or if I think it's fucking utterly brilliant. And I don't want to get into it too much, but the fact that I even have to, like, I had to think about it as much as I did when placing it on the list and think about that story and what, like, sort of very specific things say about the themes and what the story is trying to do and sort of some of the symbolism in it, like, it, like, regardless of whether or not maybe, like, possibly I don't think that is the best decision they could have made, it's a really interesting, bold decision, and, like, and the rest of the game is so interesting and so unique, and I had so much, it was so fascinating playing it the first time through, that's why I had to place it at number two.
Right. Yeah, Gone Home is fantastic.
And then plus, you know, like, I had a lot of difficulty figuring out where to put it on the list, but this is the only game to feature VHS tapes of X-Files, so that automatically bumped it up. So,
well, yeah. I mean, that's just such a great detail. Because
that it's set in the 90s, and it is fucking set in the 90s.
It captures the 90s perfectly, not just the X-Files tapes, but any of the tapes, the way they'll put two movies on one, and the way they write it.
Like, and the handwriting, you can tell, like, by the handwriting what the movie is, like, what the father and the mother obviously are, like, what movies they like.
And it's real handwriting. It's not just a typeface.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone actually wrote this stuff out. There's just such...
There's a lot of really great, like, high-res scans of, like, handwriting and real-world artwork that's in the game. Yeah.
Yeah. But anything more to say about Gone Home?
I think we established this is a fucking awesome game.
All right. So, Sean, you want to talk about our number one game of the year?
No, I think we're done. I think we should just leave it. I don't know. Everyone knows what the fuck it is, right?
I know, Number one is
Tetris! I'm sure Tetris came out on some platform this year. You had Hotline Miami. I have Tetris, one of the best games ever made. It came out on fucking something, I guarantee you.
All right, can we try this again?
Okay, sure.
Our number one game of the year is The Last of Us. Ah,
woohoo! Ah, okay, Jonathan, stop with the fucking confetti. Dude, calm down. It's every... like. Dude, I have to vacuum this shit up. This is a huge pain in the ass. Dude, she's fucking stuck. Shit. God damn it.
I'm sorry it got in your drink. You probably shouldn't drink from that.
God, fuck you, man.
All right. The Last of Us. Do we even need to explain?
We did a whole podcast explaining it, so.
We did, and we could talk, and we talked about it again on our top 10 games of all time list, because that was on mine. Yeah. And The Last of Us is not just one of the best games of all time, or the best game of 2013. It's kind of the defining game of this generation.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Or critically, the best game of this generation. Yeah. And man, you know, we've talked about it before. I think the easiest way for me to always talk about The Last of Us is that it just breaks that wall down of ludonarrative dissonance so completely and puts you so completely in the role of Joel and later in of Ellie. And the performances by Troy Baker and Ashley Johnson? Yeah. Are so good, and the story is so well told. Even though the story starts from such a, you know, it's a zombie story.
Yeah.
It's such a cliched foundation.
But they're the best version of zombies I've ever seen, because it's the only reasonable justification for having zombies I've ever seen in anything. You know, it's not just rage monkeys. It's like, okay, this is a fungus that is based on a real fungus in real life that jumped to humans. Okay, yes, I'll buy this. Yeah.
But then, just the depth of what they do with that, the darkness they go to, and how it ultimately isn't about the zombies, it's about the humans and who remains.
Yeah,
and
like every single zombie story ever.
Right.
Like, this is true of The Last of Us, but it's something I hate when people talk about zombie shit. Everyone always says that.
Right.
And it's because that's what a zombie thing is, that's what a zombie story is.
Of course.
That's always what it is. So don't ever say that again about anything ever, because it's obvious. It's taken for granted because that's what a zombie story is.
Yeah. And The Last of Us does it particularly well, particularly in its last half, which is just stupendous.
Yeah.
And I had a hard time getting into The Last of Us. I'll admit it. I thought the first, I loved the opening where you're with Joel and his daughter.
Yeah.
But then the first couple level areas, chapters.
Yeah, the beginning in Boston.
I thought it was really good. I thought, great graphics, really great characters. But there were just some things where it took me a while to settle into the game's specific rhythms, gameplay and otherwise. And I don't think I would have that problem if I played it again. But it took me a while to settle into that. But once I did, the game just takes off. And it takes off emotionally and thematically. And it just... I wound up putting this over Gone Home is it's an epic in its scale and scope, emotionally and literally. And I think it's an epic in the way where the number of great gaming memories and great moments and stuff is just so vast. And I think what it does for gaming in the year 2013 is so extreme, and what it represents, that it can't be anything but number one.
Yeah, and it's one thing, like, it's a really interesting game to contrast with Gone Home, because, well, Gone Home in a lot of ways is kind of more impressive. Like, what The Last of Us... I think, like, The Last of Us actually tackles a bigger challenge than Gone Home, because Gone Home, in terms of, like, making a video game, in some ways, it kind of feels like it takes the easy way out. That's kind of a weird way to explain it, but it's like, you know, it doesn't... Like, Gone Home doesn't tackle mechanical complexity whatsoever. It's not interested in it, and it's fine. Like, Gone Home was both of our number two games of the year, but it's a much more challenging thing to try to tell a vastly deep and interesting story and have vastly deep and interesting mechanics at the same time. You know, like, and that's sort of the story of this generation, is trying to figure that out, is trying to figure out how do you do that? And that's where, like, ludonarrative dissonance comes from. That's where Grand Theft Auto 4 failed, like, trying to reconcile those things. Like, Grand Theft Auto 5 failed in trying to reconcile those things. Uncharted failed in trying to reconcile those things. And, like almost every single game has failed in trying to reconcile them, but, like, can still be fantastic games while failing at that. And then, like, I think the indie scene has found one out, and that is make very small, focused games that either are entirely mechanical, something like a Super Meat Boy, or something that is small and focused but is entirely story. And that would be something like Journey or something like Gone Home. Actually, Papers, Please is an interesting one that kind of bridges the two. But like, that's sort of like where indie games have gone, is like they go super far on one side or super far on the other. And Last of Us is the only game I've ever seen to actually bridge that gap. And
completely.
Like... The combat is fucking fantastic, and particularly part of it is it plays to my taste and my sort of, like, changing taste in video game combat, and that, like, it has, like, Splinter Cell Blacklist has a very similar sort of very aggressive stealth that I absolutely adore. I think this game does it phenomenally well. This game handles sort of risk-reward choices in its mechanics really well, in terms of, like, the sort of survival horror elements of you have only so many supplies, you have a very small amount of bullets, but you have a lot of different supplies and a lot of different guns that are good in different situations at hand. And so a lot of different combat situations, you can, if you're loaded up, you can tackle certain combat situations however you want. Or sometimes you have absolutely fucking nothing. Like, literally all you've got are your bare hands and a 2x4 that's on your back. And that's fucking it. And you're trying to kill 10 dudes. And you have to figure that out. And...
Those are the best moments.
Yeah, those are the best moments, is when you're at your absolute wit's end. I mean, that's when you're most in tune with Joel as a character. And it feels like it captures that experience of a movie, almost kind of like a Bourne movie or something, like that kind of action movie, where the challenge of the character is like, or Die Hard, like how the fuck do I tackle this challenge? Like all the creative solutions you have to come up with to try to beat this scenario. It puts you so in tune with the hero in that moment of, like, how the fuck do I do this? And it's so stressful, and it's so harrowing, but then it's so... You feel like a fucking god when you do it. Like, you feel like this unstoppable fucking badass when you actually pull it off. And that, in terms of the mechanics, that is so well done in The Last of Us, that it's like, that alone could stand up as one of the best games of the year, even if the story wasn't as remarkable as it is.
And the story is so remarkable, and I think it comes together so clearly, like in Bioshock Infinite... In that, you know, last chapter in the hospital, you know, not spoil any more than that, it happens in a hospital. And
there are hospitals in this game. God, Jonathan, stop spoiling it for everyone.
But what you have to do in that hospital and how you are motivated by your knowledge of the character and story, that is, you are so in tune with Joel and his panic and frustration and everything. It's and demorally complex. Here's the thing. Last of Us is not a game centered around choice. That's not what it's about. But you have to analyze choices so much, and the moral nature of the choices the characters make. Because Naughty Dog made a very wise choice, I think, in this game. This couldn't be a choice oriented.
Yeah, game. That's not what it is. The game could not possibly have a branching story because they have like specific themes and messages and specific ideas they're trying to get across.
Yeah,
and you know, it's kind of like the Stanley Parable thing of like every game has to find a different balance with choice,
right.
and structure in this game. Finds that, you know, it has immense amounts of choice in the combat design, but the story is immensely structured because that's what it needs to be what it is. Yeah,
it needs to be, but, and here's the thing that makes it work, is that because you have that level of freedom in the fighting design and everything, yeah. when it comes to the story moments and what Joel or Ellie do, you understand them because you are yeah. at one with them, and you have to analyze those because you are complicit in it. You are complicit yeah. in everything you do because you have brought them to this moment.
Yeah.
And I think it's immensely interesting on that level.
Yeah, and then just in terms of, like, it's not just video game endings, but endings for a story. Like, they're obviously, like, there are so many different ways they could choose to end this game. And but especially for a video game, having an ending on this, like, really sort of dry, dark, immensely ambiguous note that, that yeah. this game ends on is so sort of bold. And it's so refreshing because, you know, most video games, you're so used to, like, the ending being, oh, the world's going to blow up. And you save it at the very end, and then there's, like, a sequel hook. You know, like video game endings traditionally are fucking awful. Like it's
like Grand Theft Auto 5.
Yeah, like, it's one thing about video game storytelling that, like, the biggest pitfall, and this thing is mostly because of how long video games tend to be, is that they can never find the right way to end it. And this has actually been a really good fucking year for endings in video games, because it's like, Brothers has one of the best fucking endings ever, Gone Home has one of the best endings ever in terms of, like, that game. Like I said, like, at least the way I look at the ending, I think it's fascinating. Bioshock Infinite has one of the best endings ever, and The Last of Us has a fucking extraordinary ending.
Yeah.
And that's, like, that's, it's so, I'm so just happy to see that, because it's, like, it's always where video game stories fall apart, is at the very end. It's, like, these ones not only nail it, but it's, like, everything hinges on it, and they fucking nail it. Like, it's critically important that they nail it, and they fucking do, and that's so,
yeah.
it's so fucking good.
And, you know, Last of Us is, I think, an influence on both of us to stick with Sony for the next generation. Because yeah, if yeah. Naughty Dog belongs to Sony...
Yeah, exactly. Like, this Naughty Dog team, the Neil Druckmann team, like, I want to see what they're going to do next. Because this yeah. was fucking extraordinary.
Yes.
You know, especially going from Uncharted, which is, like... Obviously, like, Uncharted is also a third-person shooter if you're being very broad. But, like, The Last of Us is such a huge departure in terms of tone and the way they handle ludonarrative dissonance. It's unbelievable. Like, yeah. it's crazy to me that they're made by the same studio, and yet it also seems incredibly appropriate that they are.
Because, you know, this one has Nathan Drake. That's not the actor's yeah. name, is it?
No.
Why am I blanking on Nathan Drake's name?
Yeah, and now that you've done it, Nolan North. Sudden, I can't. Nolan North, thank you. Like, because his name begins with an N, like, I couldn't... separated right. from Nathan anymore, you fucking asshole.
I'm sorry. No, Nolan North's, you know, role in The Last yeah. of Us. He's
I didn't even realize was him until I saw the credits. Right. And I was like, holy shit, guy? Like, yeah. oh my god. Like that dude is actually Nolan North's best performance I've ever seen in the game. Like,
absolutely, yeah.
Like, it's unbelievable. Like, yeah. He's really great as Nathan Drake, but that role is awesome.
And, you know, for the year of Troy Baker, this was the high
yeah.
point.
Yeah.
But...
what a fucking year.
And the year will continue, because...
Yeah. The year of Troy Baker is not done. I mean, they're making, like, a billion fucking Persona games, and Kanji's in several of them, so...
Well, and he's... The first big video game of 2014, he is the star of.
Oh, yeah, right. Infamous Second Son. Yeah, I forgot he plays the main character in that, too.
And the guy, his dude is model on him, so he yeah. even looks like Troy Baker. He's just
if
slowly
this is
taking
just the
over.
Era of Troy Baker. Like, yes. let's just call it that. Like, yes. it's... We're entering the age of Troy Baker.
And I'm happy to be in this yeah. age.
And may it last a long, long time.
I only played the Fire Emblem Awakening demo, but he's got the first line in that game.
Nice.
So he's
I
in
didn't
that
even
game
know
too.
He was in that. Yeah. Fully
yeah.
fucking, like... it would just be fascinating. Like, I just want someone to interview Troy Baker and just, like, ask him what, like, when he recorded all these games that came out this year and, yeah. like, are coming out very soon. Because it's like...
When did you have time?
Yeah, exactly, because especially Bioshock Infinite and The Last of Us, he was the main character in both of them. And so he would have had to do huge amounts of voice work for both those roles.
And The Last of Us was fully acted. Mo-cap.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, mocap, too. It's
so,
like,
so much longer, more intensive process than voice yeah, acting.
Because, like, I've heard, like interviews with other voice actors, that like even just, like, Steve Downes, who plays Master Chief, that's like, just the number of, like, groans and screams and shouts you have to do takes, like, days to record. It's,
yeah.
It's insane.
They just, yeah. they have him in a studio somewhere, and yeah. he just, they give him lines, and he says
them. Yeah, and just, like fucking force-feed cocaine into his veins so he never sleeps. That's gotta be what happens, right?
We are not suggesting Troy Baker is a cocaine addict.
Yeah.
Just that he has had it thrust upon him.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't do it by choice.
Yeah. All right, so anything else to say about The Last of Us?
It's really fucking good.
It is. You want to give people a recap, because our numbering got a little... We're in the middle.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Your number 10.
My number 10 is Rezogun.
My number 10 is Proteus.
My number 9 is Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell Blacklist.
My number 8 is Rezogun.
My number 8 is Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag.
My number 7 is Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag.
My number 7 is Papers, Please.
My number 6 is Papers, Please.
My number 6 is Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons.
My number 5 is...
Did we skip one of yours?
Yeah, we skipped my number 8.
What was your number 8?
No, we skipped my number 9, Batman Arkham Origins.
Okay, your number 9 was Batman Arkham... How did we fuck... This was the entire point of doing this, was because we fucked it up before. How did you fuck it up again? How did you... Okay, we're taking it from the top. My number 10 is Rezogun.
10, Proteus.
9, Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell Blacklist.
9, Batman Arkham Origins.
8, Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag.
8, Rezogun.
7, Papers, Please.
7, Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag.
6, Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons.
6, Papers, Please.
Okay, scroll back up. You scrolled my list off the fucking page. What is wrong with you? 5, Grand Theft Auto. 5.
5, Hotline Miami.
Hotline Miami didn't even come out this year. God damn it. 4, The Stanley Parable.
3, Bioshock Infinite.
2, Gone Home.
1, The Last of Us.
Okay, there we go. Jesus Christ, Jonathan. You are just the most immense fuck-up.
Well, thank you. That is mean.
Yeah.
You're starting...
It's not my fault! Don't blame me because I'm pointing out the truth, motherfucker. Don't shoot the goddamn messenger.
Okay, what was the worst game you played this year?
That's a good... I mean, I didn't really play bad games. I'm just going to say this because this game has been really pissing me off and I'm probably just going to stop playing it. It's Need for Speed Rivals.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, once you get further into that game just fucking pisses me off because the one thing about Need for Speed Rivals, I'm not going to talk about this game much, but the one thing that that game just does not understand is pace. That game has no sense of pace whatsoever because, basically, you know, Need for Speed Rivals, it's called Rivals because you have the racers and the cops. And I've only been really playing as the racer so far, and when you're playing as the racer, whenever you cross a cop, at all, no matter what is happening, the cop will start chasing you.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Yeah, and what that happens though is that when you get the higher level cars, which I have, like I think the car that has like heat level 4 is like by default, that's like the best car I have. Once you have heat level 4, if you cross a cop once, like just going out of the gate, literally this happened to me the last time I played the game that made me stop wanting to play the game. I like came out. 5 seconds, I literally just drove out of the hideout. A cop saw me, and since I have a high-level car, my heat level is so high by default, helicopters automatically start chasing after you. Fucking helicopters, for doing nothing. I literally didn't even break a law. Like, not even a street law. I fucking backed out of a garage, and the cops sent helicopters after me. And then, like, I literally was on a 30-minute chase across the fucking city, because once the cops... have a high heat level, it's like impossible to get them off your ass. And there's no good way. Like, I've never found a tactic for getting them off your ass. They just, it either just kind of happens or it doesn't. Or it happens and then you think you're out, like you've escaped. But then all of a sudden it will literally just spawn another cop around you. And if they get close enough, the whole thing resets and you have to keep on running away. And the key thing is that, like, as you're playing that game and you're out driving around, you're building up speed points and you need speed points to upgrade your car. But if your car gets wrecked or you get busted by the cops, which is just if the cops wreck your car, you lose all those speed points, so you have to bank them. But the longer you're outside, the higher your multiplier becomes, and you need your multiplier to get fairly high once you're at like my level to get speed points worth anything, because you need like 200,000 speed points to like buy a new car, right? Basically. So, but it's completely impossible to do, like, I can't do a race, basically, anymore. Because as soon as I go outside, there's so many cops after me, and there's no way for me to get away from them easily, that it's like, I can't go do a race, I'm just running away from the cops. And it's like, so I was out for like 30 minutes, and while I was being chased by the cops just by running away from them, I built up like 150,000 speed points, which is what I needed to complete my, like, objective. But as soon as I escaped the cops, I was on my way back to the hideout, and then the cops found me again. I went on like a 10-minute long chase, and then they killed me that time, and I lost all those speed points. I got really fucking mad, and then I turned the game off because it's like the game becomes unplayable because it has no sense of pace whatsoever. There's no downtime. There's no, you know, then that's the main difference between it and Burnout Paradise. Is Burnout Paradise, if you want to, you can just sort of chill out and drive around the city and it's no big deal and it's just, you can kind of have fun. And Need for Speed Rivals, there's no fun anymore. There's no fun. It's just stress. It's constant burning stress. And the story's really stupid.
I can only play it in about 30 to minute to hour long bursts, but I enjoy Need for Speed Rivals a lot. I skip all the story stuff. I actually
I mean, the story stuff is like completely avoidable, but just really, but it's great in how dumb it is. The writing is fucking insane.
I use a lower level car, so I have not encountered that level of problem. But
The game just becomes unplayable at some point, at least for me.
I enjoy that game. Not a top 10 or anything for me, but I enjoy it.
You haven't gotten to the shit.
What's
yet?
The worst game I played this year?
Yeah.
I actually played some shit. Here are the ones I didn't like that I played this year, like that I played a significant amount of that I really didn't like.
You played Knack.
I played Knack. Yeah. And Beyond Two Souls has good things to it, but I just got to a point where I literally realized, I don't want to play this. And I just turned it... Like, I have no ill will towards Beyond Two Souls whatsoever. I want to make that clear. I think it's got some really good stuff and some really bad stuff. But I just turned it on one day, started playing, I was like, I don't care. And I turned it off, took the disc out, and sold it.
Yeah, that was the fucking best. Because there was, like, one podcast you had just got Beyond Two Souls, and you're like, yeah, this seems pretty cool, because it was your first Quantic Dreams game. And I was like, it's gonna fucking turn on you, man.
And nothing... The thing is, nothing changes. The game doesn't get worse. I know it gets silly because I've looked up the Wikipedia line, but
you didn't even get to the shit of a Quantic Dreams game.
It never deepens. Yeah. It's, if you've played 5 minutes of it, you've played 20 hours of it. It's the same.
But it was so fucking funny when you just came on the podcast. You're like, yeah, I'm having some fun with it. And then literally next week, like the first thing you start talking about is like, yeah, I sold that game. It's like, oh!
Yeah.
Jesus, okay. Man.
I haven't played a ton of this game, but I got Dive Kick because everyone was talking about it and it was cheap. Dive Kick is the stupidest fighting game I've ever played. I
like Dive Kick. I mean, I haven't had a chance to like have a lot of fun with it because I have no one else really to play it with. But
I don't. Maybe you and I should play it together sometime. Sure. But I don't. So far, no.
I think Dive Kick. I think like all the trappings around Dive Kick are really dumb. Like it's trying to be funny, but I think that part of it is stupid. But I think the core mechanic is really elegant in a lot of ways. Although I think Because like for those of you who don't know, like Dive Kick is basically it's a fighting game where like one hit and you die, and it's like I think it's five rounds, or it's like five, you have to win five rounds. Right. And so but you have two buttons basically. You have dive, which isn't actually dive, it's just jump, but then you have kick, and it's called Dive Kick because that's like a really annoying, like cheap spam move in most fighting games is like the Dive Kick attack. And but so like all you can do is jump in the air and kick. And that's sort of supposed to be the elegant aspect of it, is that it's like it's the end of every single round of a fighting game where it's like you know, like one more hit and I'm dead, and like the pressure's on and it's really intense, and that's sort of really elegant in design, and I think it works. Though the main problem I have with it is that there are too many sort of like special moves and other characters that are just like really fucking weird, like Stream Monster, that get in the way of that core design, that sort of distract from the elegant simplicity of it. That's like, I think they had this brilliant idea, and I think they went too far with it by putting in, like, they boiled it down and eliminated all the fighting game bullshit into this like beautiful core, and then they added fighting game bullshit back onto it with like the special moves and the characters, and I think that sucks. But
that's what I don't like about it. Anyway, no, but really, my worst game of the year, Knack. I have to talk about Knack for a second, just because Knack is so mind-numbingly awful. It looks really nice. It's graphically really nice. I think the story and voice acting are okay, even though they're totally throwaway. But, and you start out and you're thinking, okay, it's fine, it's just a brawler, you know, there's got some cool ideas to it. But then you realize, for one, that it's completely fucking repetitive. Same thing every screen, every room, every time. Even when they have things like Ice Knack and Fire Knack, would you think Ice Knack would have different moves than regular Knack, Sean?
Probably, yeah.
No, he's just Knack. Nothing changes except he looks different. Nothing. He's exactly the same. It's unbelievable. And it's so mind-numbingly just repetitive. But then, once you get into levels 2, 3, 4, you get deeper into it, if you're just playing on normal, default setting, normal, it is so tough. It is unplayably difficult. Because you have to do everything right. You cannot make a single mistake on any screen or you're fucked. Because it's got the weirdest difficulty curve I've ever seen. Where you start out as super weak and anything will kill you in one hit. And you build to being invincible by the end of the level. Where you're really big and you have so much HP, it doesn't matter how many times you get hit. There's a reason we don't curve difficulty like that in video games. Because that's fucking stupid. If you start out as weak and you are against strong enemies, and then you just suddenly become strong, and so the last half of the level is just a grind where you just defeat everything, It's not fun. It's really difficult, really frustrating. Then you get really big and strong, and it's just boring because you're just knocking through everything. So that's how every level just falls apart for me, is that's just so stupid and so difficult and dumb. And I've heard that it's not like that as much on easy, that if you played on easy, that that's what was intended for kids and stuff. They need to reevaluate what the word normal means. Normal does not mean terribly difficult. Normal is baseline experience. So that's totally fucked up, and you can't change difficulty on the fly, which sucks.
So, now I've thought of something, as I have a different answer now. And this doesn't... Okay, so this doesn't actually count because, one, I haven't actually played it. Two, it didn't come out this year. And three, it isn't even out in America.
Fuck you.
But Final Fantasy X HD got released in Japan. Final Fantasy X and X-2 got released in Japan. So, Final Fantasy X is the worst game. Actually, X-2, even though I have never actually touched X-2 at all, I played some of X. I've watched all of X with my friend. Well, like, my friend played and I watched. But X is the worst game I played this year, even though it doesn't qualify in any way, shape, or form. But I just wanted to bring it up because I read a really funny thing online about apparently in Japan they released a novel called Final Fantasy X 2.5. Which, like, how fucked up has that numbering gotten at this point that, like, you have this continuation of that story that is X 2.5. But basically, X 2.5, I've only read, like, the basic synopsis, and I don't know if this is totally accurate because it was kind of a weird fan site because it's a Japanese novel. But apparently, one of the first things that happens is that, like, Tidus dies at the end of Final Fantasy X. I'm going to spoil that because it's not a good story and you don't need to fucking play that game. But Tidus dies, and then at the end of X-2, he comes back, and he and Yuna, for some reason, have a relationship, even though Tidus is the worst character ever made. But in 10.2.5, apparently Tidus and Yuna are now somehow are trapped on a desert island, and one of the first things that happens is they get in an argument, and Tidus is so angry that he goes and kicks what he thinks is a blitz ball, which is like basically a soccer ball or a volleyball, but they have a stupid sport called blitz ball, so it's called a blitz ball, and he thinks it's a blitz ball, but it's actually a bomb, and he blows up and dies, and then Yuna has to bring him back to life. And just reading that sentence in that synopsis was fucking amazing because that is exactly... Because the guy who wrote the novel is the dude who wrote Final Fantasy X. So that dude has come to understand Tidus the same way I understand Tidus as a character, which is that is totally the first thing I would do if I was writing a continuation of the Final Fantasy X story, is I would have Tidus kill himself in the stupidest fucking way possible, which is kick a ball on a desert island that he thought was just a ball, but was actually a bomb, and then blows himself up. So
you could not make this shit up.
Yeah, exactly. So I just wanted to say Final Fantasy X was the worst game I played this year, even though it doesn't qualify, just to bring up that story and have some link to it.
Okay.
So there we go.
I'm going to talk about TV for a little bit.
All right.
Is that okay?
Sure, go ahead.
What TV shows did you watch this year, Sean?
I watched Doctor Who. I watched Broadchurch. That was a show that came out this year.
Talk about it in a minute.
Broadchurch show, yeah. I don't think I watched any other shows that are like actually out this year. So
Doctor Who... So I made a top five for TV. Yeah. And previously I've done a top 10, I've written it up on my website and all that stuff. I just didn't have enough time this year to see all the TV shows I would have liked. And there were so many I need to catch up on that I'm really interested in. And I, you know, I probably could have made this out to 10, but I wanted it to be competitive. So it's just five. Shows I had to leave off that I was kind of sad to leave off were primarily HBO's Girls, BBC's Doctor Who, and NBC's Parks.
Although, understand, like, because Doctor Who, like, this year specifically, Doctor Who is just, like, that's a weird... Because it had, like, half of a season, then a 50th anniversary
but I
special,
think
the Christmas special.
All I'll say is Doctor Who had some great
episodes.
Yeah,
it still had
year.
Some really good episodes.
Like, Doctor Who this year, I would have probably found room for in my top 10 for Bells of St. John, Rings of Akaten, Nightmare in Silver, Day of the Doctor. Those are great Doctor Who episodes. Maybe if I'd seen everything, it still wouldn't have come in at top 10, but I just wanted to mention it because I thought Doctor Who had a weird year, but good episodes.
Yeah, but I understand why it's not up here.
Right. So my number five for the year, though, was Broadchurch. If you didn't see this, I think it aired in America on BBC America. And this was a... Broadchurch is so interesting because it's a story you've seen a million times on TV and a million times this year on TV because there were a lot of serial killer stories this year. But basically, it's a small
serial killer story.
No, I meant like just a murder mystery story. But yeah. No,
Murder mystery. You see a lot of murder mystery stories every fucking year on TV, Jonathan. Yeah. It's TV's bread and butter.
But this year had a lot of notable ones, like also Top of the Lake. And they did, and I've seen some of Top of the Lake. I didn't finish it. I feel bad about that. But anyway, Broadchurch happens in this small town in England. It's called Broadchurch. And it's basically about how this murder of this young boy basically affects this small community. And that, to me, is the key to understanding.
I mean, it's basically... like, have you ever seen Twin Peaks?
No.
Yeah, because it's kind of like Twin Peaks, only not crazy. It's like if Twin Peaks was made by a British person who wasn't David Lynch.
Yeah.
Basically. Because it is all about this murder. Like the murder happens, but the actual story is more about analyzing how the murder affects the town and then exposing all these different characters that are in the town.
Yeah. And I think... What I'll say about Broadchurch is it's a whodunit, and I figured out who did it at the beginning of episode 2, and I was completely right. And I figured it out totally. But and because I just knew thematically what they were going for. Because basically the point of Broadchurch is, what is going to hurt the most? What answer is going to hurt the most? And I feel like they tell you that right up front in the pilot is, maybe you don't want to know who did this. Because that's only going to bring more pain. And that to me is the key to what makes Broadchurch so amazing, is it questions the need for this kind of detective work. We need it because you don't want to murder her out in public.
Yeah.
But the actual desire to know, that's probably a flaw in human nature. Because knowing the only option, whoever it is, it's going to hurt. But because this is a small community. Mm-hmm. But the specific one they go with, obviously, hurts the most. And it tears this fucking town apart and our main characters apart. And, you know, Olivia Colman is the main character, and she is tremendous. If you've seen Olivia Colman in other stuff like the movie Tyrannosaur, you know she's a great actress. This is her best performance. She's terrific in this. David Tennant, 10th Doctor himself, plays her basically boss detective, the main DI. And he's tremendous, too. And I just think the specific way it goes about showing how humans process this kind of really difficult, impossible, painful situation is so beautiful. And the last episode in particular, and how unflinching it is. And I think the last 20 minutes or so is all about how there is no answer.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that it, because a lot of murder mystery stories, you know, end right when you catch the killer and don't, like, analyze the fallout of it at all. And I love that Broadchurch, in the last episode, they leave a big chunk to just deal with, like, dealing with the fact that it's, like, this person in this community is a fucking killer. And, like, this person knew people, like, loved people, and it's, like, and people loved him, and it's, like, okay, like, this is a fucked up situation for everyone involved, and you have to look at that, you know?
Yeah, Broadchurch is terrific, and I think they're doing a second season. That's stupid. We don't need it.
Yeah, because especially, like, this season ends in such a way that's like you could manufacture a way to make a second season, but there's no natural way to manufacture a second season out of it.
And although it's possible the second season won't involve these characters, and that would be an anthology show. I don't know, but
like that could totally work. Yeah. It's and they're doing why you need to still call it Broadchurch.
The stupider thing is they're doing an American remake with David Tennant. Yeah. So it's not. Is it a remake? I don't know.
Like it would be fucking hilarious if it was a. Like, retelling of the same story, but David Tennant was playing the same character after having gone through this. Like, he moves to America, there's an American town named Broadchurch, where a young boy dies. There's a, like, sort of, kind of sassy, like female detective that he ends up sort of working with to try to solve the murder. And then runs into all these sort of, like, characters along the way that are weirdly, incredibly similar to all the people he ran into the British Broadchurch. Like, if that was it, that would be fucking amazing. It was totally self-aware about it. Like, David Tennant's character was just, like, walking around totally befuddled about the similarities.
And I will say, you know, this was made by Chris Chibnall, who is a Doctor Who writer. Mm-hmm. And honestly, after seeing this, Chris Chibnall would be my choice to succeed Stephen Moffat because he can run a fucking show.
Like Broadchurch is there's a tight ship he runs. Yes. Yeah.
So really, and great production values. It looks gorgeous. Great use of the setting. Great performances all around. The other great performance of this series is David Bradley.
Yeah.
And then also, I think her name is Jodie Whittaker, plays the mother of the murdered boy, and she's tremendous. Yeah. So.
Arthur Darvill's in it, like Rory. Oh, yeah. He's really good too as the pastor.
So. If you like Doctor Who, plenty of Doctor Who people on it.
And I will say, like, one thing, like, I especially appreciate about Broadchurch, because I do watch a lot of murder mystery stuff, and I really, really like the David Tennant character, because I think it takes what is normally such a hugely cliche character, and there are very cliche elements about the David Tennant character, the detective, but it's like, it's in all of these stories, there's always the dark, brooding, damaged, like, male detective at the head, who is incredibly obsessed with the case, but then he's also always a fucking genius. And the thing about Broadchurch that I love is that David Tennant is not a genius in the story. Like, he is a smart guy, he's a good detective, but he's just a fucking detective. Like, he is not, you know, he's not Sherlock Holmes, you know? He's not that kind of dude.
Right.
And one thing that's great about it is that, like, you kind of get the sense that if he was that character, like if Sherlock Holmes had shown up, or like any of those, like the Vincent D'Onofrio in Criminal Intent, like that kind of character, Luther, Idris Elba and Luther, like if that guy showed up, he would solve this case in 2 fucking seconds. You know, he was just like, look at like the evidence, like look at all the suspects and be like, it was this fucking dude, like this, and then walk out. But since it's just an actual proper police story, like in that format, like it's, you know, it's not like a hugely complex murder. It's not that hard to figure out. But using actual police evidence, like actual police tactics, and not being like super genius man, it is hard to figure out on the ground, like to decide who it is, you know?
Right.
And I think they do a really good job of creating that character and not going too far with it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So that's my number 5 for the year. My number 4 is Game of Thrones, the 3rd season. Have you seen any of this yet?
No, I'm waiting for it to just end. Because okay. I hate catching up on shows. So.
And Game of Thrones is a tough one to watch year to year. But I'm in and I can't get out now. And Game of Thrones had its best season to date this year. Season 3 was fantastic. I think they fixed a problem the show had in its first and especially second season, where the storytelling was too diffuse because they have so many characters and so many locations. And they still have that. It's got this travelogue feel to it. But I think they tightened the screws a little bit. They pulled everything together a little bit better, where each episode feels much more thematically linked. If we go to a character in their story, it's got something to do with all the other characters and stories we saw in that episode. And so it felt tighter overall. I think they did such a better job with that. It's such a big show. It's got such scale and scope to it, especially in this 3rd season. All the characters click. Some characters I thought I wouldn't have ever warmed to before, like Jaime Lannister, coming to their own this year in such great fashion. You know, last year, Peter Dinklage was the lead of the show. Very clearly, this year, Peter Dinklage wasn't in as much. It was much more of it's totally an ensemble, and I'm fine with that. And I love Peter Dinklage's performance, but having everyone kind of be equal partners in this big tapestry show is great, and I think you definitely start to see the show taking shape and the overall story. It definitely feel like we started getting payoff. And, of course, there's been a lot of talk about how much they nailed the stuff that happens in the penultimate episode. They do. It's fantastic. I have not read the books, but I had that spoiled for me almost immediately, because if you Google Game of Thrones, things get spoiled for you, sadly. Yeah. You know, maybe you're just trying
to... Or if you just, like, vaguely are aware of it and know who is in... Like this season, and then all of a sudden that actor's not on the show anymore. It's like, well, now when I watch that show, I know that dude's gonna die. Fuck.
Right, that kind of thing. So anyway, but Game of... Man, season 3 was fantastic. I the whole thing, all 10 episodes, really, really good. HBO is doing something very special here. It's, you know, it's big blockbuster storytelling, but there's nothing else like it on TV, even remotely, and that's pretty cool. The production values... the level, the kind of complexity and epic nature of the storytelling. They're doing it very well, and they're doing it better than they have before. So season 4 comes back soon, and I'm damn excited.
Cool.
My number 3, Sean, this is a show you should watch.
Okay.
This is Hannibal on NBC.
Yeah, I've been kind of curious about it.
Talk about a show that shouldn't work, because Hannibal Lecter has been played out for a long fucking time. You know, he's got two good movies, Manhunter and Silence of the Lambs, and then a lot of shit. There's 2 good books, Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs, and then a lot of shit. And Hannibal has sadly, and Hannibal Lecter himself has sadly inspired a really dumb tradition in serial killer storytelling, where serial killers have to be awesome, and we have to kind of like them in a weird way because they're cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you really shouldn't like serial killers, but
that's the whole point of serial killers, is that you do like them and you don't understand why. I mean, that's
I guess so, but
one of the things that makes them good serial killers is that they're intensely charismatic.
But I think here's the thing, though, is that I think what a lot of post-Silence of the Lambs serial killer storytelling has not understood is that I think there has to be that duality to it, though.
Yeah,
I think
there definitely is.
I think a lot of serial killer stories, though, go too much towards the charismatic angle.
Yeah.
And what Anthony Hopkins did well, what Thomas Harris did well in the original Hannibal books is that you are disgusted by Hannibal. You hate Hannibal. You think what he does is awful.
Yeah, but
you are
fascinated by him.
Yes, you're fascinated. Yeah. You're attracted. You see how he could evade suspicion.
Yeah.
And what Brian Fuller did so incredibly well with Hannibal, the TV series, which aired on NBC earlier this year, is he took kind of the basic. He went back to basics. Thomas Harris, Red Dragon. This is a pre-Red Dragon story. Recenters it on Will Graham. Hannibal is not the main character at all. It's about Will Graham. Will Graham, played by Hugh Dancy, Great, great performance. But anyway, we recenter on that character, and it becomes about... Hannibal is a part of it. Mads Mikkelsen is terrific. This is my favorite version of Hannibal Lecter, easily. I think he's really interesting because, as good as Anthony Hopkins is, that human being could not exist in real life. Anthony Hopkins is a cartoon Hannibal Lecter, and he's a great cartoon Hannibal Lecter, but to me it's very big. Mads Mikkelsen is very reserved. His Hannibal is someone you can absolutely believe would evade suspicion for as long as possible because... He's just, you know, he's sort of aloof and European, but he's not overly, overtly evil. And the other thing they do dualistically with him is that he's a therapist in this version, and he actually cares about his therapist work. He's invested in that. And I like that duality, that he can be a serial killer and fuck with people, but he also genuinely cares for his real, like, day job. And that's really interesting to me. He's very hard to understand, and there's so many layers to this show. But back to the main layer, it's all centered on Will Graham and Hugh Dancy's performance, and the way he's affected by working, basically having to get into the mindset of serial killers and what that would do to a person, and how he kind of goes insane in some ways over the course of the season because of the what's so difficult about this. It's 13 episodes. All but one of them are fantastic. It's just so well told. It's serialized but has non-serialized elements. You know, each week... Not each week there's a killer of the week or anything like that, but there are other cases they're working on over the course of the season, but they all feed into the character progression. They all matter. When all the strings are pulled together at the end of the season, you see why every piece had to be there. It ends on such a brilliant note. It's so it's just the style of it is great. It's got probably the best cinematography on TV today. It is amazing cinematography. All the performances are great. We've also got Lawrence Fishburne as a really interesting Jack Crawford. Every piece of this works so well. I think this is the best version of the Hannibal Lecter story that's been told. If it had just been this one season, that would have been perfect because the specific story they tell is great. And it's absolutely a horror story. But it's a horror story just done completely right. And they are doing a second season. It's coming back soon. I'm really excited to see where they go from here. And if they're going to do more than one season, I hope they get to build all the way up to Red Dragon as they've been intending. Hmm. But Hannibal is really, really great. So you should see it sometime.
Yeah, I will.
Yeah. Bye. So number two for the year is Mad Men, season 6. For some reason, people stopped talking about Mad Men this year. I don't know why. Season 6 is one of their best years. It's a phenomenal season of television. This was very much a year about the way people stagnate in their own flaws. And I think a lot of people, for reasons I don't fully understand, but maybe partially understand, I think a lot of people interpreted that as the show creatively stagnating. That's not true at all. I think the way it was exploring Don Draper and these other characters and the ways in which change is difficult, if not impossible for them, was really fascinating. And it builds to one of the best finales they've ever had. The season premiere, actually, is the best season premiere they've ever had, easily. Some of the character work throughout the season is just stupendous. Some of the new characters they have, like Bob Benson, who was a delightful mystery throughout the season. Lots of great stuff with all those characters. John Hamm gave his best performance to date in the role of Don Draper. And Mad Men just continues to be, I think, overall the best show on TV. And this year it was beat by a specific season of one other show. But overall, in the last 6 years, Mad Men has been the best thing on American TV, and it continues to be. And there's not much more to say about it than that.
Yeah, except for now, Doctor Who is on BBC America, so it doesn't... So Doctor Who is the best thing on American TV.
Doctor Who aired The Crimson Horror on BBC America this year, Sean.
Yeah, so what? So fucking what? In the scope of all that Doctor Who has done? What about Crimson Horror? Who fucking cares?
Okay. My number one show of the year, this is just as obvious as The Last of Us being number one. It's Breaking Bad.
Oh, I thought it was going to be Sesame Street.
Yeah, it's Breaking Bad. Everyone's got Breaking Bad at number one this year, and for once, like, total communal opinion does not piss me off because, yeah, Breaking Bad was number one this year. They had one of the best final seasons ever. It was just episode for episode, pound for pound, a near-perfect final season of television. I loved just about everything they did with the characters and the story this year, and I didn't like season 5A all that much that aired the previous year. I thought that was a subpar season for Breaking Bad. It had good things and it had bad things. They really turned it around this year. I didn't even know if we needed a final season after everything that happened in season 4. Turns out we did because they did such a good job with it this year. Overall, I still would put Breaking Bad as an opus under Mad Men, but I think this season elevated the entire series for me in really interesting ways. And you can read my opinions on the whole season because I wrote about every episode for We Got This Covered. And that journey was kind of arced in those reviews where I've always loved Breaking Bad, one of my favorite shows. I think this season and how it finished recontextualizes the entire series in a way that elevates it. And that's a pretty cool hat trick, because just as video games are hard to finish, TV shows are hard to finish.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely... Because they have the same problem of, like, the length of it just makes it so hard to find a proper note to finish on.
Yeah, and Breaking Bad, it's what's so interesting is that they kind of finish in their anti-penultimate episode, and the last two are this really fascinating epilogue. And I love that pace for this season. So, really great final year for Breaking Bad. Definitely number one, no doubts there. So those are my favorite TV shows.
Cool.
Anything else to talk about, Sean?
No.
What was your favorite food you ate in 2013?
Pizza. Probably, there's probably some pizza somewhere okay. I got, I imagine. So, yeah.
Yeah.
What about you?
I don't know. I hadn't given it any thought. Probably a pizza.
Well, that's come on. We have a better answer than that.
I don't know. I discovered a new Thai restaurant. I really like their food.
Yeah. It's fascinating.
Okay. So should we end this podcast?
What was the best podcast we did this year?
I actually think that's the one we should talk about.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. I think we did a lot of really good podcasts that I was happy with.
I think
we
did a lot of terrible podcasts.
I just think I was happy with some of the discussions, and that's why I like doing this show.
Yeah.
Is I think it's fun to discuss some of these things and try to, and I think the back and forth in those discussions. Like I talked about, you know, with our Grand Theft Auto 5 podcast.
Yeah, that one was a lot of fun to do.
It was. I'm not crazy about Grand Theft Auto 5. I liked it more just talking about it and breaking things down like that. So I was really happy about that. You know, I liked a lot of the podcasts we did this year. I don't know if we could pick a favorite. I think if you want to listen to some good ones from last year, our topics on, like, big topics, like Bioshock Infinite, The Last of Us.
Like, I really like doing the podcast we can do where we talk about just one thing. Yeah. Not podcasts like this. Like, these are shit podcasts, you know, where you just, like, talk, like, for 10 minutes about something and then don't go in depth and just kind of move on to something else because we have to. Like, it's like, I don't even know why we bother, but it just seems obligatory or something. I don't know.
Wow, you are really trying to drive listeners away, Sean. Thank you for that.
Yeah, but, you know, I liked Grand Theft Auto 5 one.
I also liked our last podcast of the year where we talked about The Hobbit and the Doctor Who Christmas special. That one was really special to me. I liked that one. Podcasts like that. I also like just our random... It's always fun to record when we just have lots of news to go through and random topic episodes. I like those.
Sure.
Those don't hold up to repeat listenings, probably, but I'm excited for the next time we have one of those to do.
And this was the year that gave us Man of Steel. It's just like, that was...
That's the worst podcast we've ever done. That's a terrible podcast. Don't listen to it.
I agree, because you liked the movie for some reason. I don't know.
And you would not let me talk about it.
Mm-hmm. because everything you were saying was wrong.
Okay.
That was why.
All right, Sean and I might kill each other, so maybe there will be a new episode next week, maybe not. Yeah, who knows?
This is a bold new season for WGTC Radio going forward. I'm maybe excited. Who knows? We'll see.